Order the Services Committee meeting for Wednesday, March 28th. And we do have two bills that we want to talk about. The first one is Senate File 1824, Senator Nenow's managed care plan. We are working on an amendment that isn't quite ready yet. And so rather than just everybody wait until that gets done, I think what we'd like to do is turn to Senate File 2093 and give our fiscal analysts an opportunity to at least present the spreadsheet that we have that is attached to this bill, which is a, I guess it's an omnibus bill, although it's a fairly modest one. It seems like too big a word to use for the bill we have, but it does have a number of different provisions in it, a number of different bills from members. And so why don't we at least begin to walk through the spreadsheet and so people can understand what's in the bill and the fiscal impact of that. And then once we get the amendment ready for 1824, we'll set that aside and take up that bill. So at this point, I'd like to ask Mr. Albrecht if he'd be willing to walk through for the committee and others what's in the spreadsheet.
Mr. Chair and members, just a little overview of the spreadsheet. It shows, obviously, the governor's recommendation, the House position, as recently as this afternoon. It does reflect changes that I've gotten from House staff. And then on the far right-hand side of the sheet are the Senate items. On line 8, line 7 is the total amount in the bill. I'm only going to talk about the Senate positions. There's about $3.6 million of appropriations, and you can see on the lines below there that the state government special revenue fund and from the TANF fund in this biennium, there are no general fund appropriations in this biennium. There are tails amounts for the general fund, $50 million for the overall bill. Lines 31 to 36 show the changes in MA spending by the various categories of spending within the MA program. Lines 38, 47, 56, and 69 show the individual appropriations for agencies in this bill. Now, as I start going through the items, I'm going to skip over anything that's only a House or only a governor position and only talk about things that are in the Senate bill. And those begin on line 99 with Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill that had some changes to the critical access dental program. Total spending for that is $25,000 in this biennium. On the next page, on line number 106 is Senator Stump's bill for MA coverage for denture replacement. That is $150,000. On line 113 is Senator Nelson's bill, also dealing with MA dental, this one for developmentally disabled people. That is about $271,000. On line 123 is Senator Rosen's bill regarding nursing facilities, Medicare certifications. That costs about $13,000. On line 142 is Senator Wolf's bill to restore a portion of the emergency medical assistance program for dialysis. On line 145, you can see the amount for that is $975,000. This bill is different from the amendment the committee saw in committee yesterday. Is that today?
It's yesterday.
Yesterday. At that time, the program, the amendment didn't have funding for the tails, and at this point it does. On line 150 is Senator Hoffman's bill to eliminate the long-term care consultation. The effective date of that has been changed from when it was in committee, so there is no funding in this biennium, but there is in the next of $4.4 million.
I think you sent them. Thank you.
On line 157 on page 3 is Senator Nienow's bill. This was widely known as the ARM reform bill. It's a variety of changes for adult foster care and group homes. Has spending of $94,000 this biennium and savings of $1,030,000 in the next biennium. Line 166 is Senator Rosen's bill for community paramedics that would add community paramedics to covered services under the MA program. On line 170 is Senator Rosen's bill relating to a nursing home moratorium exception for construction projects. This changed a little bit from what you may have seen if you looked at the spreadsheet last night. I got some information from DHS that because of the way this program works, we are authorizing the commissioner to actually approve projects in fiscal year 2013, but the actual funding for those projects will be phased in the next biennium with $100,000 in the first year, $500,000 in the second year, and the remaining of that $1 million in 2016 or in the subsequent biennium after that. On line 174 is Senator Lori's bill relating to foster home certification and licensing. On line 178 is Senator Rosen's bill with a capped appropriation for critical access nursing facilities. Line 182 and line 192 both relate to the continuing care rate reduction. Line 182 is the repeal of it. And on line 192 is a payment delay that delays payments in June of 2013 into July of 2014. Line 201 is Senator Sharon's MAEPD, the Employed Persons with Disabilities Program. On the next page, on line 221, is Senator Hoffman's welfare fraud prevention, where the provisions that spent money, $204,000 this biennium, but there is $2.7 million of savings in the next biennium. On line 238 is the General Assistance Program Earned Income Disregard Increase. That was a Senator Olson bill from last year. On line 247 is TANF refinancing, showing that savings in the general fund for MFIP cash assistance, and that funding is being transferred to the TANF fund. Line 253, this is a technical provision that is required because currently the forecast balance in the health care access fund is zero, and there is a statutory transfer in the health care access fund that currently is not fully funded, so any spending in the health care access fund has to be offset with the savings in the general fund. There are no Senate items on page 5. On page 6, on line 329, is Senator Rosen's bill for the child care assistant absent day changes. Spend $3,000 in this biennium. On line 349 is Senator Hand's bill for the Intractable Epilepsy and People, Inc. On line 377, now we're moving into the Department of Health. Is the Department of Health portion of Senator Benson's bill relating to the mandates, health coverage mandates evaluation. There's also a small amount of money in there that will be transferred to MMB for their costs related to that activity. On line 381 is funding for Senator Fishbach's radiation therapy facilities capacity study. That's for a separate bill that I believe was on the floor today. On line 389 is Senator Hand's bill to transfer the regulatory activities for HMOs from the Department of Health to the Department of Commerce. On line 459 is Senator Gerlach's bill for the Nursing Board and the Nurse Licensure Compact. On line 537, this is the other half of line 389, reflecting the appropriations and revenue that would go to the Department of Commerce with the transfer of those regulatory activities, with the exception of line 548, which is Senator Benson's bill, the Department of Commerce portion of that, for the health coverage mandates evaluation. And that has an effective date such that the funding for that activity is in the next biennium. And, Mr. Chair, that's the end of the spreadsheet.
Okay, thank you. Are we, Ms. Kavanaugh, are we ready with the? Are there any questions from members for Mr. Albrecht at this point? I guess you're good. You're good to go. What we'd like to do is. Have testimony on the bill that we have, and I understand there's a list of people here that would like to offer some testimony. That there may be a few amendments that folks would like to offer, and we will certainly take those up as appropriate. I would like to offer to members the suggestion that we would like to try to keep our we don't have a target because we don't have a we're not trying to work into a budget, but we do have some dollars that we're spending. We're doing this through TANF funds that are available. But I would like to try to keep that number about where it is. It's about where the other body's number is. So I'm trying to make sure that we don't get too far afield if we and we will likely end up in a conference on this bill. So I just would offer that as a comment before we start getting into amendments. And I, it may be appropriate to start taking some testimony from people who are here, just out of consideration for the time. And I did want to address Senator Nienau's bill, but I don't think that amendment is quite ready yet. So perhaps we can take some testimony from people on the list and. I wonder if I should. I think members, I'm not going to take up the bill yet. I will invite testimony that we have on the list. But when we start to, after we get done with Senate File 1824, then we'll officially take up 2093 and start to go through things in more detail and also entertain any amendments that folks may have. So. At this point, if we could take some testimony from some of the people on the list, I've got Bruce Nelson and Ann Henry, and so please come forward and welcome to the committee and identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Bruce Nelson with ARM Association of...
Could you bring the microphone close so that we can pick up your comments on the...
I apologize. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We're an association of providers who support people with disabilities across Minnesota. And I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and those of you in the committee for a number of items that are in the bill and one that's not, that we very much appreciate.
I hate to interrupt you again, but you need to maybe tip the microphone up a little bit and get close to it because they're having a hard time picking up your voice.
Okay. I thought I projected really well.
You're doing better.
Thank you very much. The first item is something that's not in the bill, and that's a fee related to a section in that's a new 245D and regulatory language that's in another bill. We appreciate that we're not moving forward with the fee, and that's linked to the payment methodology agreement that's been worked out. Want to particularly thank you for finding a way to solve the 1.67 contingent care cut. That was a lot of money, and I think the agreement worked out to shift the payment into another year and a repeal. It was a very good one. Also, I counted about 15 reform measures from our bill, and thank you, Senator Nienau, for authoring that bill and carrying it. And those items are intended to find savings and efficiencies within corporate foster care and to facilitate the movement of people who don't need that level of care or support out of corporate foster care. And we try to do it in a way that would maintain stability within the current system. And that's why, moving to another topic, maintaining stability in the system, that we look forward to working with you on two other items as this bill moves into conference committee. And number one is the de-licensure or decertification of corporate foster care beds. And that approach, we believe, is a very destabilizing way to do what we're trying to do and you're now trying to do in your bill around reform. The other item is trying to deal with the 10% lower need cut. And as you know, many of those people who were assessed as lower need are not lower need. And we would like to continue to explore with you ways to at least mitigate the impact on people. A lot of people with mental illness, quite a few people with developmental disabilities who do have very high needs, and the impact on the provider's system, and more importantly, the impact on people with disabilities. So all said, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to hear them.
Thank you for your work on the parts of the bill that we've incorporated, and just your work generally. We all appreciate it very much. Are there questions from members of the committee? Thank you again for your help.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is Ann Henry.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. And very briefly, I first want to thank you very much for the MAEPD language, Medical Assistance for Employed Persons with Disabilities. I am very, very hopeful that this will become law and people will be able to both take advantage of their savings when they retire and also be able to work past age 65. I want to support two amendments I hope are going to come, so I'll just mention them, and at the time, if there's any more information, I'd be happy to talk about it. One is to get a broad need determination process to mitigate the cut that I think Mr. Nelson was just talking about, an immediate closure of adult foster care beds. And this is a process to replace that immediate mandatory closure with a voluntary process to the extent we can. And the other amendment that we hope to see tonight is for a pilot project to improve self-directed services under the home and community waiver. Finally, I want to mention an issue of grave concern to many, many Minnesotans that I hope we can work on as the bill moves forward and into conference committee, and that is the 20% relative PCA rate cut. As many of you know, the litigation resulted in the judge deciding last Friday that the cut should go through, and that is of great concern. I think there's been tremendous support recognizing that this is not a good idea. There are many non-legally responsible relatives who are at their own economic disadvantage, giving up jobs or restricting themselves to take care of their loved ones. And there are areas of the state where there's just no one else that's going to drive to take care of them. So hopefully we will be able to work on some resolution and not have that befall people. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Sue Abner Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Sue Abner Holden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. NAMI came in with kind of three priorities this year, and you took care of two of them, so I want to thank you very much for that. The first was to make no more cuts to the mental health system, and I really do appreciate that, kind of what a difference a year makes. We were concerned, still are concerned, about the 10% cut to the low-needs people on the CADI waiver, since many of them are people with a mental illness. But I recognize there's only so much that you can do. I really greatly appreciate including in the bill Senator Lori's bill, and appreciate your support, Mr. Chairman, so that we can really improve the quality of corporate foster care for people who live with a mental illness, really increase that transparency, and recognizing that people with a mental illness recover and get better, and so closing the bed behind them doesn't really make sense since we don't have many other places for people. And some of those beds are actually crisis home beds where we really do want people to be moving out quickly. So again, I really appreciate you taking into consideration our concerns and addressing them this year, and thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Heidi Hulse. And Kari Thurlow. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We thought we'd do this as a package deal to try to save time with the committee, if that's all right.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Kari Thurlow. I work with Aging Services of Minnesota.
And I'm Heidi Holste, representing Care Providers of Minnesota, and together we're the Long-Term Care Imperative.
We just wanted to touch on a few items and highlight a couple of portions of the bill that we are supportive of, and want to thank the chair as well as members of the committee for working with us on a number of issues. There may be a couple of amendments that we'll work on as the process goes through, but we want to mention a couple of things. To start off with, we want to thank members of the committee as well as Senator Rosen for her leadership on funding for the moratorium exception process for nursing homes. The bill does include $1 million of funding for this process, as well as technical changes to adjust for the economic the impact of the economic downturn on previously approved projects. It's important to note that this funding for the nursing home moratorium exception process will not only help nursing homes fund critically important capital improvements, but it will positively impact Minnesota's economy, supporting over 2,000 new jobs and over $300 million of new revenue into Minnesota's economy. We also want to thank the chair as well as members of, for including an efficient opt-out process for the mandatory long-term care options counseling that is in current law. Senator Hoffman, Senator Lori, thank you for working with us on this issue. The bill does now include a form that consumers can easily sign to decline options counseling if they do not wish to go through this mandatory process, and we're very supportive.
And, Mr. Chair, we'd also like to say thank you for the repeal of the 1.67 cut. We represent elderly waiver providers who have experienced administrative and legislative cuts in recent years in the double digits, so this will help alleviate some of those concerns. And then, finally, the inclusion of the Nurse Licensure Compact. We really appreciate the inclusion of that. It will make it easier for Minnesota employers to access nurses from additional states in a more efficient manner.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for your work and for your testimony. Thank you. Reverend Mark Peters. and Lyndon Garboy. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Hand, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here tonight to speak with you. My name is Mark Peters. I've been executive director of Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota since 1995. Seen a lot of sessions come and go. Our office is a partnership ministry of the six Minnesota synods of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, about 1,200 congregations across Minnesota, and about 800,000 Lutherans. A top priority for us this legislative session, as it has been for a number of years now, is to preserve a viable safety net. Beyond this mere preservation, it is my hope that your work to complete this bill today will build upon and substantively embody the bipartisan recommendations of the Legislative Commission to End Poverty, the goal of which is to lift people out of poverty. A couple of pieces. Every family on MFIP has kids. And 7 out of 10 MFIP recipients are children, half of whom are under 5 years of age. By investing in families with children, you contribute to reversing such troubling and recent trends as a 62% growth in the number of Minnesota children in poverty during the first 10 years of this century, hunger in Minnesota that has doubled in the last 5 years. Children were 40% of visits to Minnesota food shelves in 2011, and 4,500 children and youth are homeless on any given night in Minnesota. These are indeed troubling trends. I especially wish to conclude my remarks by stating that my appreciation for that the proposed cuts in assistance to kids, some of those proposed cuts that we oppose, are not included in the bill that is before us today. So to express my appreciation for that. In conclusion, as joining Christians as enter this Lenten season to Holy Week and Easter, that I'd like to highlight our core faith values as expressed by the six bishops of the ELCA and of the six Roman Catholic bishops and the Archbishop in a letter to the governor and legislators last year, that the most telling measure of how well we care for each other is to consider how we treat those who are most vulnerable among us. We do tonight serve that purpose. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Reverend Peters. Next, we have Lyndon Garboy. I hope I pronounced your name correctly, followed by Dr. Alice Holbert.
Hi, my name's Lyndon Garboy. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. There's a lot of terrible stuff that's not in this bill, and that's okay. But overall, it doesn't do what needs to be done in these economic times. I just want to speak first to the things that we think should be gone from this bill, and that's Article 3, Section 2, 3, and 4. Essentially, they're proposals that just create more bureaucracy, more Big Brother, and feed into the nasty and false stereotypes of the poorest amongst us. It's outright discrimination against the poor. If these sections were to apply to everyone else who gets state money, there would be an outcry. There's plenty of people and corporations that get state money, and they get thousands and thousands and thousands of times more than poor families are expected to live on. Just to think of a few, the Job Z-Zone recipients, owners of state-subsidized entities like professional sports teams, wealthy people who get tax break after tax break after tax break year after year, corporations scamming the state by claiming to be foreign operating corporate operations, and many others, including yourselves, who get state money. Just to jump into what needs to be done, and just a reality check again, MFIP grants are less than one half of 1% of the state budget. The MFIP cash grant for a family in extreme poverty has not been increased since 1986. That's 26 years ago. A family of three is expected to live on $532 in cash per month. You can't even find a studio apartment for that in most of this state. No one is going on MFIP because they want to. And in these hard economic times, people who have never thought they would be applying for aid are, and they are seeing how hard it is and how deep in the hole you have to go to even qualify. So during these hard economic times, what you should be doing is making it so that people can get the help that they need without feeling like they have to fall further into the hole. The grants should be increased. It should be the shame of having to apply for this aid should be taken away so that people will not have to lose everything, go homeless, break all their ties in order just to get this little petty bit sub-poverty living. So I just want to, I'll stop there. I would urge you to delete those sections, and I would urge you to raise the grants.
Thank you for your testimony. Dr. Alice Holbert, followed by Jan Alzweiger.
Good evening. My name is Alice Holbert, and this is my partner, Wayne Lindholm, who's been working with me here. We're parents of young adults who are living in group homes, and we just wanted to make some comments about the sections of the bill pertaining to group homes and the future for those kinds of organizations. I want to thank you for the good things that are in the bill, the 1.67 and all the rest of that, and also for the fact that you do not have $4 million in cuts made to group homes to promote new programs like that other house came out with. The two areas that we wanted to comment on were line 22.9, the section where respite care will be allowed in group homes in a fifth bedroom, and they will allow up to 24 people per year to come through a house. I think that's stretching a little bit what a house or a home is, to have 24 different people coming through in a year. And also, I think that's a real imposition on a neighborhood for a four-bedroom house, supposedly, to have 24 different people coming through. It seems a little extreme. Also, respite care beds are very expensive, and I'm not sure how that's going to be paid for. It's about $300 a day for an emergency respite care placement. So I don't know how that financially fits in here. The other area that we had concerns about were here in section 43.16 and the inventory study, which is going to only assess individuals who are receiving foster care. That doesn't really get to the point of the study. I think if you're going to spend money on a study, you want to have useful information. And to get the whole picture, you need to understand all of the people who are qualified to receive foster care, whether they are in foster care or not, and see how that would impact the whole bed situation. It's the only way to get to the bottom of it. So I would recommend supporting Ann Henry's amendment, which addresses that and does it in a very nice way. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Next, Jan Alzweiger, followed by John Thorson. I don't see Ms. Alzweiger. I usually see her in education committee, but welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Thorson with AFSCME Council 5, and I'm here to testify with concern for Article 5, Section 1 of the bill. It's the PEEP moratorium. PEEP, Public Employee Insurance Program, thanks. A Public Employee Insurance Program is a product that local units of government can use to bring competition into the health insurance market where it doesn't exist to fit their needs. Primarily, it's a product that's been around, run by the state for 25 years, that has offered insurance of almost a last resort for small units of government in greater Minnesota, school districts that may have as few as 75 employees. But it's also a tool of competition for a health insurance product for large units of local government, counties, cities. I'd like to speak to AFSCME Council 5's experience with the city of Minneapolis. And I'm speaking also today on behalf of the State Firefighters Association, the Minneapolis Federation of Police Federation. And in the city of Minneapolis is a health shops for a health plan to cover 5,000 employees, as many as 12,000 covered lives. It's the City of Minneapolis, the Park Board, the Municipal Building Commission, the Public Housing Authority, and also the retirees. In 2010, when the city was going out for bid, its carrier had offered for the 3 years of the plan an offer of 19% increase for the insurance product, and had also offered that if the city didn't go out for a bid, would bring that down to a 13% increase. The bargaining units, again, ask me, police, fire, 21 bargaining units total, including many building trades, worked with the city and brought PEEP in to give a bid. And it was an attractive and competitive bid. And we made it known that we'd strongly consider this bid as we're determining which insurance to go with. The city's carrier responded with a bid rather than a 13% increase, a 1% decrease, and price caps for the following 2 years. Just because there was competition, market competition for the insurance product. Now, in the City of Minneapolis health plan, that 14% spread, the difference between a 13% increase and a 1% decrease, is roughly $9 million a year. So that's $9 million a year for 3 years of savings to the employees, the city, and the taxpayers of Minneapolis. Another way to look at it would be for the same insurance product, but for PEEP being able to come in and give a bid for this insurance, we would have been charged an additional $27 million for the same product. Competition is good in this market, and if a moratorium were in place, the provision, Article 5, Section 1, those savings would not have been realized. We would have paid that much more, and for those reasons, we'd strongly encourage the moratorium not be in effect.
I'm good.
Thank you, Mr. Thorson. And
Mr. Chair, if it's okay,
absolutely.
Mr. Thorson had asked that I provide some context as the administrator of the program. For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division. I oversee the public insurance, public employee insurance program as it relates to Article 5, Section 1. We do have some concerns as a program administrator related to this language. As John had indicated, we do provide an offering for local units of government. We do have some concerns with the moratorium. From an underwriting principle, essentially we will have groups being allowed to leave the group, but no means by which to have similar groups coming in, therefore sort of cutting off the flow, really leaving the remaining pool unable or with limited ability to manage the existing group that's remaining. Ultimately, what we expect is that this will lead to higher premiums for the remaining portion of the group during this moratorium, and obviously that will increase the cost of local units of government. The PEEP also serves a particular niche within the insurance industry, in that we do cover very small groups, including individuals. So those folks that wouldn't normally have access to a pool, we do service individuals within the PEEP program. That this moratorium would bar those folks from coming in. I guess with that, Mr. Chair, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Appreciate your being here this evening. I do have Shannon Cunningham and Carrie Mortrude on our list. I'm not seeing anybody come to the table. Those are the last two people who I have on the list to testify. I believe that the amendment to Senate File 1824 is ready. So what I'd like to do is ask Senator Nino if you're ready to come up, and we'll address Senate File 1824, and then we'll come back and more formally take up Senate File 2093. Thank you, Senator Nino, and appreciate your work on this. Members, as you may recall, we had this in committee a couple of weeks ago, and we laid this over, and there's been some discussion about an amendment, and I believe that there is one that is ready at this point.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We members should have in their possession the A11 amendment, and Mr. Chairman, I would offer that amendment.
All right. Senator Nino offers the A11 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I'll briefly go through the amendment. The bill is in many ways substantially similar form, but the language has been restructured and does do some different things. And there is, as you recall, when we were last before this committee with, or when I was last before this committee with this bill, there were some amendments that were added. This delete all has removed all but one of those. That one amendment that remains has to do with Rule 101 and an exemption from that for managed care plans. That provision is still in the language. Those other provisions that were added are not. The language in front of us also does put some relief as far as reporting and some requirements related to that. That is, I believe, the on page one, you'll see some of the stricken language. We're getting rid of some requirements there. And then following that, you'll see, I believe that is the language for Rule 101, exempting out of that. You go farther into the bill on page, I believe page four is where the language from, or that's akin to the language from the original bill comes in, and this is the new language. One substantial difference is that the legislative auditor is instructed to contract with the third-party audit, the third-party audit firm. That's the language there you see on page 4, starting at 4.34, and the subsequent language is related to that. There also is the similar language regarding who's eligible to do those audits and the prohibition of actuarial firms contracting with both the plans and the state at the same time. One provision, this is the portion of the amendment that we were waiting on, Mr. Chair. On page 6, we just added some language on starting on line 6.1, that second sentence. We were just referencing back to existing statutory authority that the Office of Legislative Auditor, the Legislative Auditor has, and we're just clarifying that the contractor, as an agent of the OLA, does indeed have that same authority, and that's the language that we were waiting on for the amendment, Mr. Chair. We also have a requirement starting on 6.8, I believe, where the commissioner will be annually assessing managed care and the county-based purchasing plans, looking at various things here for, the language has changed a couple of times, Mr. Chair, as the versions I've seen, so I'm trying to recall exactly what we left in here.
Mr. Chair, I know you're talking right into the microphone, but could you project a little?
Sure.
Because I really can't hear you, and I'm like 10 feet away from you. I'm so sorry.
Well, it's got to be at least 14, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well whatever it is, project. Like you're on a theater stage.
I appreciate your comments, and I do think that the acoustics in this room and the sound equipment is a little sketchy for whatever reason. I don't know. So I just encourage people at the table to
use an outdoor voice, Mr.
Right.
Chair.
All right.
The outside voice. That's
thank
it.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, there, line 6.19, just redirecting savings from the elimination or modification of the reporting requirements, rolling that back into associated costs with the other new reporting requirements. And subsequent to that, you see some excuse me, Mr. Chair. The evidence-based childbirth program, the commissioner may discontinue some reporting requirements there. That is, Mr. Chair, that is permissive language. I don't know that that means that that will happen, but that is allowed to happen. And then we have some streamlining in subdivision two, some streamlining of some reporting and some repealer language related to, again, more reports, and I believe also related to Rule 101.
All right.
And so, Mr. Chair, the principles and the concepts of the bill really are pretty much the same. The details have changed. We have added in some mandate relief and relief on reporting requirements and redirected savings resulting from that back into any costs associated with the new reporting.
All right. And my understanding, certainly now from talking to our fiscal analysts, that the amendment also, there was about a $1.8 million cost as this bill came into committee, and my understanding is that cost has been relieved by the amendment, so there is no fiscal note. I did want to invite, if Mr. Nobles is here, since this is a little different and it does place an expectation on the legislative auditor, if he'd be willing to come forward and just address that, if, assuming he's had a chance to absorb it, and maybe make a few comments about that. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, to the committee, record, my name is Jim Nobles, the legislative auditor, and this is similar language to what was adopted this morning in the House. It is language I've worked on with Representative Gottwald and Senator Nenow. I think the Office of the Legislative Auditor is in a position as an agent of the legislature and with a mission of accountability to take on this responsibility and achieve the results that you desire.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Nenow, Section 5, I don't recall this being on page 6 there, the evidence-based childbirth program. I know that did generate savings when it was originally brought in, and I'm just wondering, you had that reviewed, too, by the department, and that didn't have any fiscal cost associated with it? The evidence-based childbirth? I mean, we had savings. If I recall correctly, I mean, it came in.
I think, Sir Lurie, I believe this is just addressing a reporting requirement, not the program itself. It's not eliminating the program.
No, it says may.
It says the program.
I'm sorry?
The evidence-based
Mr. Mr. Chair, the language regarding the program is permissive. If the commissioner deems that it's not an effective program, they are allowed to discontinue. They are not directed to discontinue.
Okay.
There is discontinuation of some reporting in there as well.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
And Sir Lurie.
So I guess my question was, did the department take a look at this and agree that there was no fiscal note? I mean, what are they anticipating discontinue? I mean, we were expecting savings from this program, and I guess I'm just asking, you know, was that evaluated? Are they anticipating discontinuing the program? I mean, I see that it says that, you know, once hospitals representing 90% of births covered by MA have approved policies and processes in place to prohibit elective inductions prior to 39 weeks gestation, which was kind of the core of what we were looking to accomplish with this evidence-based program anyway. So, I mean, maybe that is a good alternative, but I just hadn't seen this before, and it did bear a little conversation, I think.
And Mr. Albrecht, were you going to make a comment? Sorry, Mr. Lights. Dr. Light.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, the language here essentially reflects what is actually currently in statute that gives the commissioner permissive authority to discontinue the program once we get to 90% of the hospitals having adopted the policy. The only distinction here is that it also puts a hard stop on the reporting requirement that's placed in place once we reach that level, so the department doesn't have any concerns, and it doesn't impact on the fiscal note.
Thank you.
Thank you
for that clarification.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, just one correction. The gentleman, Scott?
Mr. Lights,
said that they can stop when 90% of the hospitals, and I just wanted to be clear, the language is hospitals representing 90% of the births.
Yes, that's what the language says. Thank you for that. Appreciate it. All right. Mr. Nobles, appreciate your work on this and your willingness to participate in going forward and helping to bring some light, we hope, onto this whole process.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you. Other questions on the bill? Senator Nino, I appreciate your work on this. I think what I would recommend is that we move this along. I think that we need to get it to Rules Committee so they can travel on its own. I think that we may want to consider adopting your language into our omnibus bill, perhaps at the end of the evening, just to make sure that we're covered in case we need to have it there. But if you're prepared to offer a motion, we can.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Lurie.
I think, you know, I was looking into the rules a little bit. I think the proper motion would be to direct it to the floor and Rules intercepts it and hears it. So, I mean, if we move it to Rules, they ask, well, what did you want us to do with it after we see it? So, I mean, I think the proper motion is to move to the floor, and Rules will just automatically intercept it, and then they'll know, then they'll have direction as to what our intent was from the committee.
That's,
I mean,
right.
I think.
I'm willing to do that. Are you, Madam President, are you okay with that?
Works for me, Mr. Chair.
All right. All right.
Mr. Chair,
right,
I will make the appropriate motion.
All right. Senator Nino moves Senate File 1824 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. Motion carries. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would like to ask Senator Rosen would be willing to chair, and we will take up
2993.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And the first thing I'd like to do is, as an author's amendment, move the A3 amendment, which is to delete everything, which brings all the elements that were reviewed briefly by Mr. Albrecht into the bill, the language. And so if I could do that, I would make that motion.
Senator Hahn, I know there is a technical amendment to the A3 amendment. Mr. Milo-Baker.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, the A9 amendment is a technical amendment, and I believe everything is, for the most part, it's purely technical. However, there is one somewhat substantive change, and that is the language for the MAEPD program changes in the bill, in the A3 amendment. The wrong version of Senator Sharon's Senate File 726 got put in. And so if you, I'll wait till everybody gets a copy, but this essentially adds language of Senator Sharon's A5 amendment to Senate File 726. And those changes can be found in the amendment on line 1.7, beginning on line 1.14, and on beginning on line 2.24.
Of the A9 amendment?
Of the A9 amendment.
Okay.
1.7. Say them again, 1.7, 1.24.
1.4.
1.4.
And page 2, line 24.
24.
I need to get a copy of the amendment. Somebody's got an extra copy of the amendment?
No, you're not allowed.
Okay, that's right, we got it. Sorry, we got it.
Might help.
So, Madam Chair, could I incorporate the A9 into the A3, or do we need to adopt those separately?
Absolutely. Any questions with that, with the A9 amendment being incorporated into the A3 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Oh, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, is it just those three lines, or is it the whole A9?
Mr. Lobeco.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, those three lines are in relation to the MAEPD change that I had discussed. So the other changes are purely technical in nature.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Higgins. Any further questions?
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. A3 is adopted.
And Madam Chair, what I'd like to ask perhaps some help from our Senate counsel and analyst Mr. Lobeko and Ms. Kavanaugh to perhaps help just walk through the articles briefly so that I don't forget anything, and maybe you could divide these up. You probably worked on them separately, so if I could invite them to just briefly walk through the provisions in the bill. Most of them were briefly outlined, I think, in the presentation of the spreadsheet, but there are some things in the bill that may not show up on the spreadsheet since they may not have any costs associated with them. So,
okay. Senator Hand, we do have two testifiers, too, that would like to come up. So it is your pleasure if you'd like to have Shannon Cunningham and Carrie Mertrude from the Nurses Association first, or if you'd rather have the walkthrough.
Well, why don't we do this, Madam Chair, since we'd invited them to come up earlier to testify in the bill. Why don't we just let them offer their testimony before we get into the detail of the bill.
Very good. Senator Hand. Shannon Cunningham. Carrie Mertrude. Hello.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Mertrude, and I'm with the Minnesota Nurses Association. And I'm speaking in opposition to Article 5, Section 5, the National Nurse Licensure Compact. The Minnesota Nurses Association believes that the National Nurse Licensure Compact is going to create potential job loss for Minnesota nurses by creating an option for other nurses from other states to come and take our jobs, as well as put patients at potential risk because we won't know who's here working in Minnesota caring for our patients, as well as we feel that the state of Minnesota abdicating their right to govern and regulate nursing practice. So we do know that this is going to be moving on the House side on its own, and so we would like a consideration that it be deleted from the omnibus bill and just let it travel on its own. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Mertrude? Ms. Cunningham, would you like to say anything? Oh, okay. Thank you very much. And Ms. Allswager?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota, and I have a document that I would like to distribute for you to consider. Some of you may have seen it before. If someone, can you hear me okay now?
Yeah.
Okay. If we can get a page or someone to assist to pass these out. Education Minnesota does not support the provision that would put a moratorium on new entrants into PEEP, the Public Employee Insurance Plan. As some of you know, over the years, Education Minnesota has been struggling with the high cost of insurance for school employees, and so we attempted at least at the legislature, to pass a statewide health insurance pool for all school employees. And it was not successful over a number of years. And legislators, Democrats and Republicans, said, what you should do is have a plan that is voluntary, that provides for competition, and you should use PEEP.
Thank you.
As a result of your comments and of our investigation, we were able to get approximately 220 locals, exclusive representatives of school districts, to seek a bid from PEEP. As a result, and this is very important, as a result, we believe that school districts and school employees saved possibly as much or more than $100 million. We know it's millions and millions of dollars. I have passed out a document that we just gathered in the course of a week of information that was informally presented to us about the savings that they saw as a result of the bid for PEEP. And if you look at them, you will see, as you go through, over $1 million saved in the Roseville District alone. Over $2 million saved in White Bear Lake in 1 year alone. A 10% reduction in premiums for the Edina School District, and a 23% reduction in consultant fees for that Edina school district. And I could go on and on. Now, there are two in here that saw an actual double-digit increase in premiums. One is Cambridge, one is LaPorte. So why did they see such a big increase in premiums? We can only guess that one of the reasons is they did not seek a bid from PEEP. There could be other reasons, but we find it ironic that in all these the documents of all this information, the ones that had significant increases were those who did not get a bid from PEEP. It has been said that, well, if these individuals go into PEEP, that it will harm MCHA. I understand from the testimony previously that PEEP has said that there are only a total of between 4,000 and 5,000 people in PEEP. With this bid, we only had about 1,000 individuals that were not contributing to MCHA. But look at yourselves. The state employees do not pay into MCHA. All self-insured plans do not pay into MCHA. The service co-ops do not pay into MCHA. And there are reasons for that. So, and some of them we cannot change. The bottom line is, if you compare those 1,000 employees that may have had some cost to MCHA, does not even come close to the dollar amount that was saved by school districts and the employees in the millions and millions of dollars that were saved. Our school employees want some affordable health insurance. They're not even asking for a Cadillac plan. PEEP actually, when the school employees went in, they actually had to create lesser plans because so many of our school districts have such terrible health insurance plans. One of the districts said that had we not done this work, they would no longer have health insurance. Please do not stop our ability to get a bid from PEEP. It is one of the major cost-saving factors that we have seen in school districts in a number of years. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you should have them.
Thank you, Ms. Alschwager. Any questions? Thank you, Ms. Alschwager.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Toburin with SEIU Local 284, and we represent public school support staff around the state of Minnesota. And I want to add my voice to the echoes of opposition to this legislation, and I don't want to reiterate all the things that have been said here in the past. I just want to touch on two points. The first point is that the proponents of this bill are arguing that this is necessary because we are going to see a mass of public employees exiting the insurance market and into PEEP. And that is completely untrue. That is not going to happen. A year ago, we sat in this committee on a number of other bills related to PEEP, and the testimony then was the teachers and the school employees are putting out bids for PEEP in hundreds of districts. And these hundreds of districts are going to take these bids, and they're all going to go into PEEP, and it's going to cause a cataclysmic problem. A year later, those several hundred districts put out bids for PEEP, and out of those, less than 10% actually went to PEEP. Our members who went in for PEEP bids, not a single one of them actually went forward and took the PEEP bid, because on an apples-to-apples comparison, when they were able to negotiate with the insurance companies, they wanted to stay with their current insurance provider. This gave them a tool to help negotiate, and it also gave them a tool to help look at what can we do as employees working with the employer to lower our costs. When we're really looking at what is driving the costs and what are the factors and how can we work together to try and lower our health insurance costs. The second point I want to talk about are the 8,000 public employees and their families who are currently on the PEEP program. The fiscal note for this legislation, as well as the testimony from MMB, was clear. It said in the fiscal note, it's very clear that this will have a significant negative harmful impact on the families who are currently on PEEP. Because if you create a moratorium to stop anyone from entering PEEP, what it will do is that groups will shed and leave PEEP, and that the groups that remain will be sicker, unhealthier, and the premiums and costs will rise. I was unable to get our members from Pine River Bacchus down here tonight, but they wanted to tell you their story about how PEEP is the only affordable insurance program that they were able to find up in their district, and that for them and many of the greater Minnesota public employees who are mostly the folks who utilize PEEP, this is their insurance of last resort, and this is what they rely on. And if you put a moratorium on this, it is going to have a significant impact on the folks who are currently using this program, not just the people who may use it in the future. So those are just the two items I wanted to reiterate. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Soberin. Any questions? Thank you very much. Oh, Senator Sharon.
For Senator Han, do you know, is this language in the House bill?
Senator Han.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I do not know. I want to have it in the bill because I'm not sure where it is in the other body.
Senator Sharon?
When we get to a discussion, I'm hoping we'll talk a little bit about what might or might not draw a veto in this bill, and we'll have some consideration about whether or not we want to lose the whole thing or if we want to keep what's really important in the bill.
Okay.
Thank you. Ms. Kavanaugh, Mr. Lobanko, summary?
Yeah. Madam Chair and members, if we want to start at Article 1, health care, Section 1 reinstates the coverage for dialysis services as an emergency medical condition or medical assistance for non-citizens. Section 2 expands MA coverage for the repair of dentures. And it also expands dental coverage for developmentally disabled adults. Section 3 provides medical assistance coverage for community paramedic services. Section 4 provides critical access dental, provides aid. Critical access dental clinic with reimbursement rate if they meet certain requirements and they're providing services off-site at a private dental office. This is Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill. Article 2 is the Department of Health. Sections 1, 2, and 3, and 6 transfer the regulatory authority for health maintenance organizations from the Commissioner of Health to the Commissioner of Commerce.
Do I have that?
Section 4 is the change to the requirement of the Commissioner of Health developing a plan to implement the evidence-based strategies from the SHIP program as part of the Hospital Community Benefits Program.
I'm sure I had it. But.
And section or Article 3. Oh, I'm sorry. Section 5 is the study of radiation therapy facilities that the Commissioner of Health is supposed to conduct. Article 3 is Children and Family Services. Section 1 modifies the child care assistance absent days policy. Section 2 requires the state court administrator to provide the commissioner with a report every 6 months of individuals convicted of a felony under Chapter 152. And then the commissioner is to determine whether these individuals are receiving public assistance. Section 3 requires the commissioner of public safety on a monthly basis to provide the commissioner of human services with information on applicants and holders whose driver's license and state identification cards have been canceled by the commissioner of public safety. Section 4 requires the Commissioner of Public Safety to provide the Commissioner of Human Services with information on applicants and holders of driver's license and state ID cards whose temporary legal presence status has expired. Section 5 makes a technical change that conforms with changes that we made last session. And Section 6 modifies the general assistance program by increasing the earned income disregard from 150 to 500 per month and the maximum savings account disregard from 1,000 to 2,000. And Section 7 requires the Commissioner of Human Services to report to the legislature on the implementation of sections 2 through 4.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Article 4 is continuing care. Section 1 allows MDH to approve an exception to the nursing facility moratorium if the full annualized share of MA costs does not exceed $1 million. Section 2 instructs the Department of Human Services to develop an optional certification process for adult foster care homes that serve people with mental illness. This is a completely optional certification. Section 3 exempts adult foster care homes certified for people with mental illness along with other residential settings from the requirement that once service recipients move out, licensed capacity is decreased by the same amount. Section 4 exempts adult foster care homes from the 4-bed license maximum, allowing a 5th bed for respite care with certain staffing, time restriction, and notification requirements. Section 5 clarifies that to receive a variance for alternate oversight supervision, the adult foster care license holder must not have had a conditional license issued or other licensing sanctions. Section 6 clarifies certain requirements in order to receive an adult foster care home license where the caregiver is not present during normal sleeping hours. It outlines license application review timelines and processes and approval or denial timelines and processes. Section 7 prevents a license holder from being penalized for not having an individual service plan if the case manager fails to provide one. Section 8 exempts providers of both licensed and unlicensed home and community-based waiver services from repeating annual background checks under certain conditions. Section 9 specifies that a probation officer or corrections agent must notify DHS of an individual's conviction if the individual has been affiliated in the preceding year with a program or facility regulated by DHS or MDH, a youth facility licensed by the Department of Corrections, or any type of home care agency or personal care assistance provider. Section 10 requires the senior linkage line to develop processes to assist home care, healthcare homes, and hospitals to identify at-risk older adults and determine when long-term care counseling is appropriate, effective July 1st, 2013. Section 11 adds a cross-reference for language added in Section 12, effective April 1st, 2012. Section 12 disregards, for MA eligibility purposes, the assets and spousal income up to certain limits of the MAEPD participants who turn 65 years of age and have not been enrolled or have been enrolled in MAEPD for at least 24 consecutive months. Section 13 requires housing with services establishments to inform prospective resident or their legal representative of the long-term care counseling options requirement and the opportunity to decline the counseling. Changes to the list of circumstances when consultation services are required within 5 working days are also made. The section is effective July 1st, 2013. Section 14 adds a new subdivision exempting long-term care consultation requirements under certain circumstances, effective July 1st, 2013. Section 15 states that changes to a consumer's services should be served as an addendum to the consumer's ISP. Section 16 requires a quality control council to identify financial and personal risk issues that prevent people with disabilities from optimizing community-based services, recommend statutory and rule changes to the legislature by January 15th, 2013. Section 17 allows replacement costs, new bed, per bed amount to increase under the nursing facility moratorium exception in Section 1, beginning on October 1st, 2012. Section 18 adds a new allows a rate adjustment for certain nursing facilities under the moratorium exception, again in Section 1, effective upon federal approval. Section 19 removes a reference to a subdivision being repealed from the list of exemptions for nursing facilities participating in the alternative payment demonstration project. Section 20 creates a critical access designation for nursing facilities, requires DHS to work with MDH and stakeholders to establish the designation. The grant is to be on a competitive basis and limits funding to $1 million in fiscal year 2013, which is ongoing and added to the base. Section 21 requires non-Medicare participating nursing facilities to refer dual eligible recipients qualifying for Medicare covered stay to Medicare providers. Section 22 specifies the definition of community living settings. Section 23 establishes an adult foster care voluntary closure program, requiring DHS to seek proposals for the conversion of services for persons with developmental disabilities to other community settings, and submit a report to the legislature by February 15, 2013, on the inventory of assessed needs and the total license capacity. The section outlines the process for voluntary closure of adult foster care homes if the total license capacity is deemed in excess of the assessed need. Section 24 requires service providers for those deemed shelter needy and those who meet certain requirements to transfer the lease to the service recipient within 2 years, and also allows an exemption to this requirement if the landlord is not willing to transfer the lease. Section 25 provides for federal approval of the nursing facility level of care after July 1st, 2012. Section 26 requires a DHS commissioner by June 1st, 2012 to seek federal approval to allow individuals meeting the new MA eligibility criteria to continue in the MAEPD program. Section 27 allows current MAEPD enrollees who meet certain requirements and turn 65 years of age in 2012 to continue MAEPD enrollment while the federal approval is being sought. Section 26 requires the fiscal analysis for changes in the MAEPD program to include the cost to other state and federal agencies if implementation does not occur. Section 29 describes for people who are receiving home and community waiver services the types and characteristics of living settings both allowed and not allowed in order to receive the services. Section 30 requires DHS to allow 15-minute and daily rate billing for independent living services under the BI and CADI waivers, and instructs DHS to submit a waiver amendment to the state plan to the federal government if it's required. Section 30 is repealer. It repeals a subdivision related to DHS biennial budget requirements for the nursing facility moratorium exemption process in Section 1, I believe. It repeals a subdivision regarding nursing facility Medicare certification. Repeals the language in place last year on the 1.67% contingency rate reduction for home and community-based programs and intermediate care facilities for developmental disabled individuals. Set to take effect on July 1st, 2012.
And Article 5 is miscellaneous. Section 1 is the moratorium on enrollment into the P program. Sections 2, 3, and 4 are the health benefit mandate review. Sections 2 and 3 require the Commissioner of Commerce to conduct an evaluation of any bill that's introduced or any amendment to the bill that contains a mandated health benefit proposal. And Section 4 requires the Commissioner of Commerce to evaluate each mandated health benefit that is currently required under Minnesota law and rules. Section 5 is the nurse licensure compact, and as well as Section 6, 7, 8, and 9. And then Section 10 is corrects a subtracting error from last session in the base adjustment for the administrative services unit.
All right, members, that's the overview of the bill. Senator Hand, any additional information? Any questions?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That is an overview of the bill and describes in brief the elements in it, including the things that were mentioned in the spreadsheet. I know there are some amendments, and perhaps we can just see if there are amendments that would like to be offered at this point.
Okay, who would like to go first?
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I don't have an amendment. I just have a question on line 47.26. We're adding language that says that the commissioner should seek a federal approval for level of care criteria, and then it says for adults and children. Who else is left that isn't an adult or a children? And if that's so, why are we putting that in there?
Mr. Lubeko?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, the level of care changes, the implementation dates are different for the two populations. For adults 21 years of age or older, it's set to take effect, if we get approval, on January 1st, 2014. For individuals under 21 years of age, it's not until October 1st, 2019. And so this language just clarifies that the waivers, the approval is being sought for both populations with both of those dates.
But neither of those dates, Mr. Senator Lobaco, Higgins, is in this section. It says July 1st, 2012. So how does that work?
Madam Mr. Chair Lobaco and Senator Higgins, you can, in the section you see section 144.0724, subdivision 11. That is where the level of care changes are, along with those implementation dates. The date here was from language last year, and the or after that's inserted just clarifies that if we do get approval, but it's after July 1st, for those two sets of populations, that we will then implement those level of care changes.
For both those?
For both of them. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Because you're either an adult or you're a child.
Correct.
Okay, amendments. Senator Hoffman?
Madam Chair, I have the A30 amendment.
Where is it?
Get that passed out. Senator Hoffman, if you'd like to explain the amendment, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to defer to Mr. Jeff Bartsch to explain the amendment to us, if I could, please.
Mr. Bartsch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bartsch. I represent Medica. What's before you in the A30 amendment are two pieces that were part of the bill that transferred regulation of HMOs from the Department of Health to the Department of Commerce. They're part of that bill and approved by the Commerce Committee. We're just trying to make sure that the shutters travel with the House when the transfer of HMO regulatory authority is included in the omnibus bill. Let me briefly describe the amendment. There are two pieces in it. The first piece that you'll see starting on page one deals with the definition of prenatal benefits and really updating the definition of how those benefits apply in-network versus out-of-network. Starting on page one point, or on line 1.21, that's the old definition of how we clarified that the prenatal benefits covered at 100% are an in-network benefit, but the cost sharing applies out-network. That's the old definition. The Department of Commerce, in reviewing the language, looked at it and said, how we read the old definition may not actually be up to speed with what we've been doing in practice, and so we're replacing it with the new definition and clarifying that certainly prenatal benefits are covered at 100% in-network. They're not out-of-network. That's consistent with every other preventive benefit we have in statute with federal law, with state law, and how these have been approved in a practice in the state for years. The second piece of this, starting on page two, is a change to how continuation benefits are priced in situations where there is a divorce. If a member of a group, a family in a group, if there's a divorce, both the employee and the former spouse are guaranteed coverage. That's part of our state and federal law, the state law being COBRA, the federal law being COBRA, the state law being continuation. They're both guaranteed a right to coverage under state and federal law. We're not changing that. In fact, we're hoping to strengthen it. The difference is state law and federal law differ in that state law requires that the pricing of those benefits continue to be the same as if you were a family. So there's a divorce. The law requires us to treat you as separate qualifying beneficiaries. That's an important right, particularly for the divorced spouse. But state law requires that we try to price that premium as it were a family. And that creates some very difficult situations in the administering of those benefits. There's some confusion, particularly if you have an employer who has some health insurance plans that are fully insured, some that are self-insured. You may have employees where there's a divorce who have a different situation in terms of how their rights apply, one following state law, one following federal law. You also have confusion if an employer were to move from fully insured coverage to self-insured coverage. You have to go to all your divorced spouses now and explain to them how their coverage may have changed. I think the biggest concern is, under the way the state law reads, if you have a former spouse who may want to choose a different benefit that is offered from the employee, they may want to choose the richer benefit. They may not be allowed to do it because the premium that's charged to both of them cannot be more than what the employee themselves would have chosen. That may be confusing, and this whole issue is confusing. But basically what we've done is we've created a situation in state law where the ability of the divorced spouse to choose, direct, get notifications for, and continue their coverage after the divorce has been muddled because we try to keep the pricing of that the same as if they were still a family. And so we're just clarifying that state laws and federal laws are treating those individuals the same so that they're guaranteed access and knowledge of their rights moving forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Lurie? Senator Lurie?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. The first section sounded not too bad, but the second section, I mean, I'm guessing, you know, just from people's personal experience, you know, I mean, the first person getting health insurance is quite expensive, and then to add a spouse or something is usually a much smaller number. And I wasn't here, I don't think, when we made this policy in Minnesota that I guess is different from the feds, I'll accept that. But my guess is people are getting, a package that is much cheaper, and this would have an effect on the premiums that people would face. And I'm wondering if there's been any analysis done on that, if there's anybody that can answer that question. I mean, it's actually strikingly different in what I've seen. You know, to add your spouse is an incrementally smaller number than to get your individual coverage. And so if we've got two individual plans, both at that much higher rate, I mean, and I think many of us probably read that Star Tribune article on the wife who was canceled because her husband, you know, the state employee's policy was canceled and she wasn't able to be notified. So, I mean, I think there are things that we need to work on, but I am worried about the pricing for that divorced spouse. And can you address that, or is there anybody from the department or any other testifiers who've looked at that issue and have any thoughts?
Mr. Barsh.
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, I think every situation in terms of how you try to determine what the premium would be varies based on the benefits that are offered by the employer. That's not only the richness of the benefits, but how they determine the benefits. Some employers still offer single coverage and then family coverage, and family could include one, two, how many of our dependents. Many employers are offering single coverage, single plus one, two, three, and then after three you get family. So each situation, and if there's a pricing differential, that would differ based on the specific benefits that an employer offers. Certainly if you had a situation where there were two individuals, a husband and a wife, the wife was the employee, there was a divorce, having them pay two single premiums may not be more than the family premium. If you have a situation where there were family members involved paying one single premium and one family premium versus one family premium, that would be an addition. The law doesn't say you actually have to price at the family premium. It says every time you do this, you have to look and see if the premiums you would price are more than the family premium, and they cannot be more. So what you really have is a situation where every time an employee gets divorced and the employee or the divorced spouse gets married, remarried, divorced again, has kids. Currently, that is all priced as one family. You can have five families priced as one family under the situation because state law requires that every time there's a divorce, that's a qualifying event, that person gets coverage, but they can never be priced more than the family. And so while there certainly may be a few instances where someone moving from family to family pricing would be paying more, there are certainly just as many instances where you have multiple families whose premium is capped at one family level because of the way state law applies.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you for that. You know, I'm not certain it really totally answered my question, though. I mean, I get that every individual case is different and that it is complicated, and we know a lot of complicated family situations. But I mean, in aggregate, does anybody know, you know, really how this is going to play out for, you know, an average situation of a recently divorced couple, something like that? I mean, is this? That's what I have in my head, is this recently divorced couple, and maybe we need to put some limits on it. I mean, once you remarry or something, I get that, you know, but the standard situation, it just feels to me like that we're going to be imposing a much higher premium, and we should know that. I mean, I'm not even saying it's necessarily wrong. I'm just saying we should know that, and I'd like to.
Mr. Parsh.
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, I can find some examples for you. I don't know how it's possible to get an aggregate. I think it would be easy to find a couple situations and look at what the difference between a single or a family premium would be. Again, in some of those instances, two singles will be close to what a family premium is. In some instances, they won't. So, again, the situation depends on, again, multiple factors. Are there other dependents involved or not? But I can certainly try to provide some information for you on a few standard product examples to help answer that question.
Senator Hamm, advice.
Madam Chair, I would like to ask if there is any fiscal cost to the amendment. Do we have a note attached?
I don't think so.
No.
Being advised, it went to the Finance Committee, and there is no fiscal note to this. And so I would have no objection to adding it to the bill.
Senator Hoffman, I can see why you wanted him to explain this.
Absolutely.
Any further questions on the A30 amendment? All those in favor of the A30 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you,
Senator Hoffman. Thank you, Mr. Barsh.
Madam Chair.
Further amendments? Mr. Hayden, or Senator Hayden. Mr. Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to offer the A22 amendment, and in following Senator Hoffman's lead, I'd like to bring in Mr. Goodnow to explain the amendment.
It's cheating.
Then maybe that might help us.
That's right.
Sitting next to me too long, Senator Hayden.
Welcome, Mr. Goodnow.
I'll be shorten things up
thank
a little
you.
Bit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Hayden. I'm Kevin Goodnow. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Home Care Association. What the A22 amendment does is, last session during the shutdown negotiated bill came through, there was a family deductible that was placed on all people that received medical assistance. That family deductible started to be implemented this year, and what it does is every month that a family, they receive a service during a month, there's a $2.55 family deductible. A provider started seeing that $2.55 deducted from their payments starting the last couple of months. And what this does is, in the past, and in the spreadsheet spreadsheet that was passed last year, it didn't include or show a savings associated with long-term care services. However, subsequent to that, we were told by DHS that they've included the cost of that in the forecast. So what this amendment will do is to exclude long-term care services from the $2.55 deductible. Typically, those are community-based services that are provided to frail elderly and disabled adults to help keep them in the community. And the one thing that I believe Senator Hayden meant to add with regard to the A22 is that this would be effective July 1st, 2013. So it would be effective for the next fiscal year, 2014.
Senator Hayden, would you like to make that oral amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to make the oral amendment. I don't know where the appropriate line would be, but to make this effective July 2013.
July 31st? July 31st of 2013.
July 1st,
Madam Chair. Okay. All those clear with that oral amendment to the A22 amendment? Okay. Senator Hamm.
Since we haven't adopted the amendment, maybe we can just incorporate that oral amendment into the whole A22. I'm assuming that that effective date, maybe not. Does this have a cost associated with it then?
Madam Chair and Senator Hand, there would be a cost to this, and it would show up in the next biennium with that effective date.
Okay. And do you have an idea of what the cost would be?
My understanding in conversations with Department of Human Services staff is that the value of this when it was implemented was about
$250,000.
$250,000? Per year or biennium?
Madam
Chair, Senator Lori, that would have been in this biennium in which it was implemented. I doubt that it's for the entire biennium. There was probably a slightly delayed implementation date by a few, maybe 3 months, maybe 4 months.
Questions? Senator Hamm.
Madam Chair, I was aware of this amendment, and I think I do want to try to hold the line on adding more cost to the bill, but I was made aware of this, and I would have no objection to it being added to the bill.
Okay. Any further questions on the A22 amendment with the oral amendment of implementation date of July 1st, 2013? All those in Senator Sheeran.
Just for my clarification, who will still then be paying the $2.55? Who remains obligated to this?
Mr. Goodenough.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, all people who are still on medical assistance will still be paying this when they access acute care services and those services that aren't exempted. But for a lot of these services, either monthly services that are continual, where with acute care they're episodic. So the same people would still have to pay it, but they wouldn't necessarily be paying it every month.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Further questions? All those in favor of the A22 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. A22 amendment is adopted.
Are you sure?
Are you sure? Further amendments? Senator Nenow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to offer the A14, the A14.
I'm sorry, what was that amendment?
A14.
The 14 amendment.
While that's being handed out, Madam Chair, maybe I could just speak to that.
Sure.
This essentially is grandfathering language. This relates to there's a 25% cap in the bill, and if that was implemented across the board, there are some living units where there are residents there right now and would be forced to move out. This is grandfathering language for some. And if we want more details on that, we have some people that are willing to speak to that. But there are some counties that have approved payment and living situations where there's more than 25% of the clients being served are on waivers, and that's their current situation. This amendment does not eliminate the language that's in the bill. It allows that to go forward, but it does create some grandfathering for some existing situations. And if Senator Hand would like to hear some more about that, we have people that would talk to that. Or if you're okay with doing that, then we can just act on the amendment.
Senator Hand.
I guess I would like to hear a little bit more about this and understand what the cost might be.
Ms. Cavanaugh, do you have any advice on the cost, or Mr. Ulbrich? With that, when he comes back, we can. Aye.
Good evening, Madam Chair. My name is Heidi Holstey. I represent care providers in Minnesota as well as the Long-Term Care Imperative. We've worked with DHS to make sure that this provision has a zero fiscal note.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Holstead? Further questions on the amendment? Senator Hand, advice?
Being advised this does not have a Senator fiscal Higgins? Cost, I would not have an objection to the amendment.
Okay. Senator Higgins, either you have a headache or you...
I have a headache, and I have a grammatical mismatch here. The which have been delivering those services, that's on line 1.7, what does that refer to? Is that the setting? Is that the residence? Is that the what?
You're looking to me, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Holsted.
It would be the setting.
The setting. Okay.
Madam Chair, then the have on line 1.7 needs to be a has.
All right. Senator Han, are you okay with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Just incorporate those oral changes. Anything else, Senator Higgins?
I think I'll sit back in my chair for a while.
All right.
Thank you.
Further questions on the A14 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. A14 amendment is adopted. Please. Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, I'll offer the A6 amendment.
A6 amendment. Is it complicated?
No, it's not.
No, okay.
It's not terribly complicated.
If you'd like to start speaking on it, that's fine, Senator Lurie.
Sure. This is on page 21 of the bill. It's in section 3 of Article 4 for the licensing moratorium where we decertify the empty beds. We've talked about this quite a bit. This was the bill that I had that I'm very glad was in here, and we've been working with the Department of Human Services to try to reduce that fiscal note. We were hoping we could get it to zero and move separately. Members may remember we dual-tracked this bill. We weren't able to get it to zero, but I think that with this will limit the ability for a bed to stay open only to license holders whose primary diagnosis is mental illness. And so it could further serve to restrict the number of beds that this could apply to and give DHS some comfort in terms of the cost. We don't know exactly what that would be yet, but the intent of this would be to just make sure that this was a small subset of those really well-functioning beds that we're going to not decertify. And so the expectation is that over time, you know, maybe even by tomorrow, but before we get to conference committee, the costs that are carried in the spreadsheet could be slightly less for this provision.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lurie did mention this to me. I believe we had conversations on a lot of different things the last few days. So I think I was aware of this, and I certainly don't object to the amendment.
Okay, great. Members, any questions on the A6 amendment? All those in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. The A6 amendment is adopted. Further amendments?
Senator Rosen?
Senator Sharon.
I'd like to introduce the A29 amendment.
What one?
29.
The A9 amendment. Oh, okay.
29. The A29, I think it is.
29.
29 amendment. Senator Sharon, if you'd like to start.
Sure. Yes. In the recent days, because of the increasing gas prices, it's been brought to my attention by special transportation service providers in the state of Minnesota, in the rural part of the state, where in order to carry out special transportation services, if you remember from the long discussions about this, in the rural area where there's huge geography, the unloaded miles are not reimbursable. So these costs, these increasing gas costs, are creating enormous changes in their ability to continue their operations. And so what this amendment proposes to do is to allow the Department of Human Services to make adjustments in the reimbursement rates to providers and is adjusted on the basis of each 10-cent increase or decrease in the statewide average price, so it can be raised or lowered at about 1 cent per 10-cent increment up or down. This adjustment will be made monthly by the commissioner within available appropriations, so there's not anything in the form of a fiscal note that would require us to find funding for this. And I would like to, with your permission, Senator, have Mike Pinsky, who is here representing rural special transit providers, speak and articulate for you the unusual circumstances that they've found themselves in and its impact on rural special transportation service providers. And also, as you're preparing Mr. Pinsky to testify, I see that Scott Leitz and, Mr. Greenman, who's been working with the special transportation service providers, are here if there would be questions for the department.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Mr. Pinsky, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good evening, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Mike Pinsky. I'm the president of the Minnesota R80 Medical Transportation Coalition. We represent non-emergency medical transportation providers that serve the 80 rural counties here in Minnesota. As we all know, fuel has gotten a lot of attention lately, and the volatile fuel market here is creating a crisis for non-emergency medical transportation throughout rural Minnesota. At current fuel prices, rural providers are already turning down rides because they can no longer break even on some of these rides. In fact, one of our members, located in the Detroit Lakes area, has turned down over 830 rides from January 1st through March 5th of this year. We fully expect that number to continue to increase for all providers as fuel continues to spike. The unpredictability of the fuel currently is the real problem. We have no idea of knowing where this will be kind of topped out at. We may be at the peak right now, or we may be looking at a peak well above the $4 mark. We simply do not know how to deal and plan with this volatile fuel market. The uncertainty is forcing providers to act sooner rather than later. And additional fuel spikes will obviously lead to more turned down rides and eventually even parking some of our vehicles. The amendment in front of you will stabilize and give us some predictability as providers, and will curb the pending crisis and allow us to continue to provide the service regardless of where the fuel prices go. We'll also protect our vulnerable elderly and disabled citizens by providing and preserving their access to health care in rural Minnesota. So I do ask for your support. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pinsky. Senator Sharon.
I would just like to add that when these rides are turned down, people continue to need the transportation, so they'll tend to, as is the case in much of healthcare, go to a higher cost service. So we really are not creating a cost savings by having people stop giving the service. This, in fact, will provide cost savings, and it's within great. I'm hoping that you'll add to this conversation, Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Leitz.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon. The department does understand the challenge that SES providers are facing, particularly in rural areas. We do have one suggestion on the language, if the author would be willing to entertain it, and that would be to I believe this was intended to be permissive language on the part of the department.
Yes.
To allow us some flexibility when prices went up. And I think we were thinking the way to more cleanly potentially do that would be on line 2.22, strike the shall and insert the word may. And then on line 2.23, strike the words within available appropriations. And that would give us, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, the ability to adjust the payments when they do increase.
I would incorporate that into my amendment.
Okay. Is that understood by everybody, the changes? So on line 2.22, strike shall and insert may. On line 2.23, strike the words within available appropriations. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Leitz, if the language within available appropriations is stricken, where does the money come from to pay for it?
Mr. Leitz.
Madam Chair and Senator Newman, I think that would be something that the that would be handled within the forecast.
Senator Newman?
What does that mean?
Senator Thank you, Rosen. Senator Higgins. What does that mean?
Mr. Lights.
Madam Chair and Senator Newman, I think that, this would indicate that there would not be a specific appropriation, but would give us the authority to, in high-cost circumstances, to increase the rate of payment for those services. And the cost of that would then be included as a forecasted program, which would show up in the next budgetary forecast as an expenditure.
Senator Newman?
Madam Chair, thank you. I will say I don't understand. Either the money is in your budget or it isn't, and that's what I'm trying to get to. So maybe Senator Hand can explain it to me.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if I can, but I'm trying to. I'll explain what I understand, and then I'll stand for correction. But my sense of the change would be that it would be permissive, allow the commissioner to make these adjustments, and would allow them to make adjustments within whatever funds they currently have available. Going into the next budget, there would then presumably be some estimate of use that then would become a purview of this committee to make a decision about whether that program should be continued in the following year. So my understanding is this would give them some permission to operate with some flexibility under the current budget, but the next budget would include this, and there would be some estimated cost to that, presumably based on whatever the price of gasoline was and the use of the program, that we would then, as a committee, have to decide whether we want to continue that in the next budget.
Mr. Albright.
Is that correct? First to
Madam Chair and Senator Hand, not to disagree with the chair,
please,
who I work very closely with often.
Please disagree.
but the reason this would not have a cost on the spreadsheet right now is because it's not telling the commissioner to do something. It's allowing the commissioner to do something. Once the commissioner does it, there will be payments, they will be made, and there will be a cost. And the forecast will just absorb those costs. The committee will not have the opportunity to speak to or address those costs before the next session or any other time, quite frankly, because they'll just show up in the forecast.
Senator Hand.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Albrecht. I just want to be clear that since this is permissive, I guess I would not want to suggest to the commissioner that the expenditures that have already been authorized should be exceeded. And so I guess that's what I'm trying to understand, is if this allows you to operate within a certain budget limit that currently exists, and then if there's going to be additional budget authority in the next budget, then that would be taken up as part of whatever the forecast would be. But I guess what I'm trying to avoid is to have an additional expenditure be built into the cost without having the committee understand what those are.
Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and Senator Hand, as you are aware, one of the things that would be before the legislature next year would be a forecast adjustment bill, and any changes that were reflected in the forecast because of this provision and numerous other things that go on in the medical assistance program, this would be just one of the many changes, either up or down, that would be reflected in that forecast adjustment bill that comes forward next session.
Right.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Albrecht.
Senator Sharon.
I would like to add to the amendment the elimination of a comma. I want to do that before yes. Senator Higgins gets in here.
I saw
you on line 2.22. Yeah.
Delete the comma okay. within available appropriations, comma.
Okay. Any further questions on the
I would just, excuse me, I just like Senator to add, that will be the amendment, but I just like to add to Senator Newman, I think that we will track and certainly we'll get feedback from the department if this is problematic in the future, if it's a place that we have to come back and eliminate this option, or understand what if there is a real implication for the budget. We'll see that in the forecast, and we may have to correct later. But for right now, this helps in a crisis time.
Senator Hahn, advice?
Madam Chair, and I certainly had conversations with Senator Sharon about this a couple of times in the last 2 days, I think. And I think I'm not averse to putting this in the bill, and we'll see what it looks like in the forecast.
Great. Any further questions on the A-29 amendment with the oral changes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. A-29 amendment is adopted. Thank you, Senator Sharon. Any further amendments? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will offer the A-18.
A-18 amendment.
Being handed out, I can address it.
Yeah.
The A-18 amendment will simply direct the Children's Cabinet, which exists currently under in Statute 4.045, to take a look at short-term and long-term costs and benefit related to Part C of IDEA for infants and toddlers, and then report that to the legislature, and that potentially anyway could determine some long-term savings if we take the right approaches there.
Senator Nino, is there a fiscal note on this?
There should not be a cost. It's just simply directing the cabinet that currently exists, made up of commissioners and some people. It's set statutorily just to take a look at this and write back to us, essentially.
Okay. So the purpose is just to get back to us, basically. Yes. Okay. Any questions on the A-18 amendment, Senator Hedekin?
Madam Chair, has the Children's Cabinet been do they function? And who's on it?
Senator Nino?
No, Madam Chair, I actually looked it up earlier at the beginning of our committee meeting, and now I've forgotten.
You're welcome.
It was some commissioners, and the governor appoints one of them to be the chair. And are they functioning?
Do they meet regularly?
That I don't know. They do exist.
Senator Hamm?
Madam Chair, I have no objection to the amendment.
Okay. Any further questions on the A-18 amendment? All those in favor of the A-18 amendments, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. It is adopted. Thank you very much, Senator Nino. Any further amendments? Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got the A-15 amendment. I had a brief conversation with Senator Hahn about this, but this is a pilot project we got going back in 2008 for community-based health care coverage. Actually, it's Senator Hahn, if you looked at it, I think you'd love this. It's kind of a free market approach to health care options operating up in Duluth. Actually, a small business and individual approach focused on small businesses with 50 or fewer employees, with low income workers under I think $18 an hour in that ballpark, and it's a kind of a organic collaborative effort that has grown and was authorized in 2008, and it's been working very, very well. The premiums are about $60 a month for the recipient and about $60 a month copay for the employer. It's purchased through the employer, what this does is it just eliminates the fact that it was a demonstration project and allows this to continue up in northeastern Minnesota. The results have been very good, and the response from the community has been very positive. The people using this are really happy about it. So it really just says that it's not a demonstration project anymore. It's not going to sunset. There's some additional stricken language on page 2 regarding some grants that initially got it going that are no longer available. So we just, to clean it up, struck reference to these grants that aren't there anymore. It had been established and operated under both the Commissioners of Health and Human Service, but health has been the prime, and we're going to leave it just under health. And you'll see that on a couple of other places. But it's just really been a real success up in northeastern Minnesota. There are a number of employers that use it, and the employees are very, very pleased with it, and it is very low-cost health coverage for these individuals. And its success is based on a true focus on preventative care and education of the people using it, and making sure that they go through their primary care provider and understand how to best utilize the healthcare system available to them. It's really been a true success. And just for members' benefit, this was added also to the House omnibus bill, so we would be getting in line with them were we to adopt the A15 amendment.
Senator Lori, I see too that they're going from a quarterly to an annual report.
Streamlined.
Page five.
Streamlined.
Absolutely, we like that. And also, you're sunsetting it much sooner than the 2014 date at the end. Is that correct?
I don't think so. I think we're striking the sunset, aren't we?
Deleting the sunset. Okay, we're deleting. Scratch that. Okay. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lori, can you, what is the scope, how many people would be eligible under this program? Is that been, is it, I guess, is it a limited to just a certain entity, or is it broad? What is the scope?
Well, it
Senator
takes,
Lori.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, it takes quite a local effort. It's a bit of a restricted network that these individuals have access to. So, I mean, you'd have to have that community collaboration between your healthcare network and your employers and these employees. So, I mean, it's kind of self-limiting in that way. In that region, I don't believe they've run into a whole lot of troubles. They're meeting the need. It's not growing terribly rapidly. Again, it's aimed at it's restricted to employers with under 50 employees and typically low wage workers, and so I mean it's limited. Nobody else has actually picked up on this at this point and tried to build more of these. Though I think with a little bit more experience, it might gain some traction, and I think that. Allowing them to continue this this project would be a good thing to do.
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, and maybe this is a question for Mr. Ulmerich. The deleted language on page one talks about this demonstration project being funded by grants, and I'm assuming if we move this out of this, then it becomes a forecasted program, or what would be the how would this be handled in the budget?
Mr. Ulmerich.
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, I'm not familiar with this program, but just based on what appears to be happening in this language, is it's if there were any funding, there wouldn't be any more after this.
Right.
After the
Senator Hahn.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
They used to get it, but they don't have. They haven't for years.
Senator Lori, let's. Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, on the deleted language on line 1.27 through 1.31. Is what had the state providing funding for this purpose. Ms. Kavanaugh has been talking to me and saying that they're not currently getting this money, that maybe they did at the beginning.
At one time, yes.
But this is that stricken language there deletes any requirement that any money go to them, so now the legislature would have to act affirmatively to make that happen. And then on line 2.17, there's stricken language also that current law allows them to receive money, and this striking it would not allow them to receive money from us, from the state.
So, Madam Chair, and
Senator Hahn.
Senator Lori, how does this get funded then if they're not allowed to receive money?
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, and thank Dennis, Mr. Ulbrich was right. This did get a little bit of seed money from some state grants and some federal grants. They are self-sustaining now. They're sustained with the contributions from the employees and the employers, and they get a discounted rate at the health networks that they are, and so it's there is no fiscal, there's nothing to carry in the spreadsheet for this, so it just really allows this little local project that has been a true success to continue operations.
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, I think I'd have no objection to putting it into the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions on the A15 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. A15 amendment is adopted. Thank you, Senator Laurie. Further amendments?
Where did you put it?
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll offer the A20.
A20 amendment.
A20. And shall I speak to that?
Sure.
Well, that's
absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a provision in a bill that I had presented to the committee previously. It at that time carried a fiscal cost, I think, of $11,000 or so, because we were directing the department to report back to us. It relates to, again, Part C, early intervention. We've tweaked the language. So basically, as I understand it, the department will report back to us if they can afford it.
That's a new twist, isn't it, Senator Hahn?
Madam Chair, Senator, you know, that means that they won't do it if they can't afford it, and if they can, they'll tell us.
Madam Chair, that's my understanding.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Mr. Albert.
On line 1.10, I'm just wondering if, despite being within available appropriations, if the word shall still means that the commissioner has to do it.
Would anybody from the department like to speak on that, or Senator Nino?
I'm looking to counsel.
Okay.
Not if they don't have appropriations for it, no.
Right. It's okay. Okay. Apparently.
Okay. Jeff, hey. The swimming pool story.
Questions, Senator Hahn? Questions for the A20 amendment?
Madam Chair, I would not object to the amendment.
Further questions? Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if the department has any opinions.
Comments.
About language that says that, you know, maybe you should do this if you can afford it. I'm wondering, it's not something that we could go nuts down here if we start doing this with every little feel-good thing. And in legislation, I think we should, you know, if we need to get something done, we should pay for it. And so I'm just wondering if the department has any opinion. If they don't, I mean.
Someone from the department like to just give us their thoughts, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ralph McWhorter with the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
I'm sorry, what was
Can
your
you
last
pull
name?
The microphone? McWhorter, M-C-Q.
Porter.
Okay. And we're quickly trying to grasp the situation here. I think the concern is tracking the referral process and the county process for those referrals. So I think that's where the costs are coming into. So the issue is when you ask us to do this, if we were to carry it out as if we were required to, we would have to develop a reporting system by which the counties would make that referral. I think at a minimum that would require us to modify and program the social service information system to accept that information for us to collect it and be able to organize it to share that report information with the legislature.
Porter? Further?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure how to speak to this issue other than what I've said so far. I understand there's been some negotiations or some conversations, but I can't speak to the full value of those.
Okay.
At this time.
Is this something that's a work in progress? Senator Hahn, Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, what do you mean by work in progress?
Well, it just seems there is some confusion about the language and the county reporting.
Madam Chair, and there has been some communication. Well, I don't know if we want to have a test for our come and speak to the details, and rather than get a third hand
No?
No.
If you would if you'd like to. Yeah.
Hello. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm from Children's Defense Fund. And just to, as Senator Nino said, I don't want to be providing third-hand information, but Children's Defense Fund has been working with the Department of Human Services for several months on this provision, and that we do have agreement from DHS that we can do these different pieces. And as far as monitoring the referral rates goes, that's why that language was included today about within the available appropriations or appropriations based on fiscal year 2013. But so looking at that piece, we had consent to go forward with this today.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps Senator Nino, do you know if this is language that has been included in the bill on the other body?
Senator Nino.
Mr. Chair, I do not know that that is the case, but I do not know that it's not the case. I'm seeing a negative head nod next to you.
Ms. Fitzsimmons.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to your question, Senator Hahn, no, this language has not been included in the House omnibus bill, but there are efforts to have it included somewhere else.
Senator Hahn.
And Madam Chair, I think I'm a little uncomfortable with not really knowing what this will do and how it's going to be worked out, but getting some advice. I think, Madam Chair, there's some question about whether or not this can be done unless there is a cost associated to it. And perhaps what, if the author is willing, we could let this go on the bill with the understanding that we would need to get a clarification of the fiscal note by the time we get to conference committee. And depending on what that looks like, it may or may not end up in the final bill. I'd be willing to give this a little bit of a chance to go forward, but it's not clear to me that there wouldn't be costs associated with it, and just would like to understand those.
Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, whatever the main author would be comfortable with, I will follow your direction.
Senator Hahn.
And Madam Chair, if that's the agreeable, I'd be willing to let this go forward, and with the understanding we'd get some kind of fiscal analysis of this provision that we could then make a closer determination in conference. Okay.
Mr. Porter, you're fine with that?
Yes, Madam Chair, and if possible, I'll try to communicate with some people during this hearing right now and see if we can follow up here and take action on it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Porter. Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimmons. Further questions on the 820 amendment? Everybody comfortable with that agreement? All those in favor of the 820 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Further amendments? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will offer the A11 amendment, and this does have a fiscal impact. So before the main author says he does or doesn't like it, maybe we could have a chance at least for some people to address the question at hand. If it's being handed out, if I could just speak to that, Madam Chair.
Absolutely, Senator Nino.
The A11 amendment simply takes $500,000 from TANF Fund for Long-Term Homeless Supportive Services for low-income families and directs that money there. And Madam Chair, we do have someone here, I believe, that would like to speak to that. And then Senator Hahn, if you could tell me if you'd prefer that not go on your bill or if you're okay with that.
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, and Senator Nino, I did have conversation, I believe, with the proponents of this provision. I am a little reluctant to add $500,000 additional into the bill. I am under the impression that there is a provision very similar, if not identical, in the other body's bill, so that it would certainly be a topic of conversation. But I guess at this point I'd prefer not to add it into the bill. And since it's going to be in the other companion bill, we'll certainly be able to continue to discuss it.
Senator Hahn, I actually had the same amendment, Senator Nino, I was going to put on. Senator Nina.
Madam Chair, before I withdraw the amendment, if anyone would like to speak to it, if we could take that opportunity.
Absolutely. Hello, Ms. Backus.
I'll be brief here. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair and committee members. Amber Backus from Leonard Street and Diner here on behalf of Hearth Connection, a nonprofit that's a partner with the state, local governments, and nonprofits working with Minnesotans with long histories of homelessness who are now in housing. Due to the budget constraints last session, the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund, which provides intensive case management to people that are in housing and keeping them stably housed, was cut by about 20%. Due to those cuts, we lost about 20 full-time employees around the state that are able to support these folks in their housing. The result of that have been clients showing up in the hospital multiple times, relapses with chemical dependency, or some folks even losing their housing, all of which cost the state more than this amendment. So we were hopeful that maybe we could have a discussion about trying to mitigate those cuts from last session and put them back into a program that is providing an investment that results in outcomes that are positive for Minnesotans in terms of their health care.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that this is a very good amendment. We did lose a lot. As Ms. Backus said, we lost about 20% of this. And, you know, members, the result of this is that very unstable people end up losing their housing because they are unable to kind of maintain their life. This really helps with social service providers going into, as opposed to a supportive housing building, but really going where people are living and helping them kind of, you know, make their mental health appointments and helping to stabilize them. And as we know, when people decompensate, they usually end up either in the jail, in the detox, or in the emergency room, which is our highest cost of service. So I do think that, and this the TANF portion of this really focuses on keeping families together. So it would be spent on families, primarily women and children. And so I know, Senator Hand, you are trying to figure out how to move this around, but this really is a worthwhile cause. I will say that I think, if I'm not mistaken, Ms. Backus, we're in about 37 counties, is that right? So about 37 counties that range from the Iron Range here in the metro and in southern Minnesota. So there are a lot of members around this table that have people that are working with the Hearth Connection to stabilize their life.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Any further testifiers on this bill or amendment? Okay.
Madam.
Senator Dean, now.
Madam Chair, I'm not going to put an amendment on the author's bill that he's not comfortable with, so I will withdraw the amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
And Madam Chair, and Senator Eno, and Senator Rosen as well, I don't not at all suggest that this is not something that would be worthy to put in a bill. What I'm striving to accomplish right now is that the two bills in the House and the Senate are about the same in terms of their expenditures. And so if there's something in the other bill that isn't in ours, that may create a discussion for us about priorities. And I guess I'd like to try to keep it in that frame. So not at all to say that this is not a worthy project.
Thank you. Senator Nino?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I do have one more amendment in Senator Hand, this is a little more substance to it, but shouldn't have any cost. And I haven't had a chance to talk to you about it yet. So if you're not completely comfortable letting this progress, I'll certainly withdraw it, and we can talk some more whether that might be something we could do on the floor or not. But I will offer the A21 amendment, Madam Chair. And
Senator Nina offers the A21 amendment. Would you like to explain, Senator Nino?
Yeah, Madam Chair, this will create a work group that will be administered and organized and facilitated and staffed by a nonprofit organization, and we'll submit some recommendations back to the legislature relating to child homelessness. And Madam Chair, I believe Ms. Fitzsimmons is still here. She probably want to speak to this or not.
Ms. Fitzsimmons?
Maybe not.
Maybe
she's
not
out of the room. Madam Chair.
Senator Nina.
Oh, I see she's here.
Ms. Fitzsimmons?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So let me just, I was trying to get clarification on the last amendment, so let me just bring up the other piece here. So just to speak quickly to this piece, this is the Visible Child Work Group Amendment. And just to give you a little bit of background, that on any given night in Minnesota, 4,500 children are homeless, and half of homeless children are under the age of five. And as this committee has heard many times before, that's a time of rapid and critical brain development, and that we also know that adverse childhood experiences such as homelessness have a tremendous impact on a developing child. So what this amendment does is it makes a commitment to addressing the well-being of children who are homeless. And it will be done in the interim with individuals who have knowledge and experience working with people who are homeless, with individuals who themselves have experienced homelessness, with homeless and child advocates, and also, of course, with members of the legislature and appointees of the Children's Cabinet. And the hope is that we'll come up with recommendations, requirements, objectives that would help create this statewide plan on improving well-being of children who are homeless.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzsimmons. Any questions on that? Senator Hamm, advice?
Madam Chair, Sardino, I'm a little leery about creating a work group that has not been reviewed by the state government or committee. I don't know if that would potentially move this bill into that committee to review. So I guess at this point I would advise that we not add it on to the bill until perhaps we get some clarification from that, and maybe something that we could address later on the floor. But do you know if this is a provision in the other body?
Senator Mina.
Madam Chair, I do not believe it is there at the moment. And Madam Chair, as I told the author, that I would want to have a conversation ahead of time on something of some substance, and if there's any discomfort at all, I would withdraw that, and we can talk further whether that's something to be addressed later another time or not. So I will withdraw the amendment, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you.
Senator Newman actually had something to say, too.
I withdraw my question.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Newman. Okay. Senator Sharon.
I just would ask for an answer on the question about where this sits in the House. Did you want to speak to where this sits in the House?
Ms. Fitzsimmons.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Senator Sharon. This bill, this amendment is included in the House omnibus bill. And then also, if I may respond to the question about state government, that it's our understanding that because it's a work group and that it will be facilitated and convened by two nonprofit organizations, so it doesn't have a cost, that it wouldn't have to go through the state government committee.
Senator Hannah, I think that's right, because I've had some things, too, that... Excuse me, Senator Higgins, what's that?
As long as it's got legislators on it, doesn't it have to?
Goes through.
Well, that's, I guess, what we're going to have to find out. Yeah. So the A21 amendment has been withdrawn. We'll continue to work on this, Ms. Fitzsimmons. Any further amendments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I have an oral amendment. I'd like to move to delete Article 5, Section 5. That's the nurse licensure compact. A few other articles. It's on page 52.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Higgins, I appreciate your offer. And it's not really my preference to have that provision in this bill. However, I do want to make sure that this provision moves forward. And it is, at this point, unclear to me what is the progress in the other body. And so I'd like to leave it in the bill. I will be candid with you. I'm not certain that it will stay in the bill after we talk about it in conference, but I do want to keep the provision moving forward, and so I'd like to keep it in the bill at least through the conference process.
Senator Higgins, further questions on this oral amendment? All those in favor of the oral amendment to delete Section 5, starting on page 52, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
Nay.
Motion fails.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
I move to delete the PEEP provision, but I can't find it.
It's in Section 6.
I saw it here somewhere. I wrote PEEP on it.
Madam Chair, I think that's in...
It's Article 5.
Section.
Article 5, Section 1.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Page 50? Page 50. Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, this again is a provision that is moving separately, but wanting to be sure of where this may be in the other body, I would respectfully ask that the committee keep the provision in the bill for now until we make a determination of what the progress of the bill as a standalone is doing in the other body.
Thank you, Senator Hahn. Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I would just repeat what I said earlier, that I think that I don't know who will be on your conference committees or how that process will go forward, but that the concern be given to those things that we know up front may create more problems than we want for other aspects of the bill.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sharon, my intent is to, as the conference process goes forward, that we produce a bill that will be fully supported, and we would certainly expect to be acceptable to the governor. But there are sometimes things that are helpful to have in the process, and this is one of those things that I think would, from my perspective, I'd like to leave in the bill for now. But I do share your concern, and it is not my concern to produce a bill that is not going to be able to make it through the process.
Further questions, comments? Those in favor of deleting Section 1 of Article 5, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those in favor, all those opposed, say no.
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 The motion fails.
What am I?
I want it out of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Lori.
I'm on record. I want it out of the bill. My head's all sore.
Good night. I voted on both sides of the bill today.
I forgot where he was. Did you?
Senator Hahn, I do have a couple of amendments myself. The first one is we, on your. A real clear is not here, right? That one? Okay. In your community benefits bill today on the floor, we deleted some of the information for the health plans, and so I'd like to make an oral amendment on the A3 delete all amendment starting on page 11, 11.30, line 30, and deleting all of that on page 11, 30 on to page 12, that whole page. And this would make it in sync with what we did on the floor today with your community benefits bill.
And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I was distracted momentarily. So we're adding the provisions?
No. Well, we are going to add. That would be the A12 amendment. But right now we're just taking out the changes that we made on your bill, the community benefits bill.
So, Madam Chair, just so I understand, we're going to do a two-step thing where we're going to delete some things, and then we're going to add in the language as we adopt it on the floor.
Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
Great. Okay. So are we all clear on that, members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins?
As long as you're chairing that, I'll move that.
Okay. Okay, thank you. I should probably pass on, though. Okay. Senator Higgins moves that on page 11, line 30, delete the remainder of that sentence there, and then on page 12, delete the whole page. Senator Hahn, you're in favor?
I would certainly support the amendment.
Okay, thank you. This came from the health plans. All those in favor of the oral amendment from Senator Higgins, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails.
Then, Madam Chair, maybe I should offer your A12?
A12.
All right, I'll offer the A12 amendment.
Thank you. And Senator Hahn and members, this is the provider peer grouping amendment, and so we're just triple tracking this, actually, because it is so important, because it was in rules today also, so it's going to be traveling separately. But just to be succinct and keep it going with what's in the House, we're going to put it into the House bill. All those in favor of Senator Hahn's A12 amendment, say aye.
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 All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. Senator Nenow, I have a few more for amendments.
It's okay. We're way past it now.
Yeah.
Senator Rosen is going to offer which amendment?
I will like to offer the A5 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen offers the A5 amendment.
While that is being passed out, it was just a basically deals with the WIC program and the maternal depression language. So basically, we're just adding information about postpartum depression, including symptoms, potential impact on families, and treatment resources at available WIC sites. And that, of course, is well, 1 in 10 new mothers in Minnesota experience postpartum depression or other serious mood disorders. Low-income mothers experience depression at 3 to 6 times that rate. So women are most at risk of experiencing depression report receiving information from their health care providers about postpartum depression at lower rates than women in less high-risk groups. So with that, I offer the A5 amendment.
Senator Hand, do you have any comment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, this does not have a fiscal note, does it?
Senator Rosen?
I don't believe so. I don't think this has a fiscal note. They're checking right now.
They're checking. Members, are there any other questions, or while they're checking on the potential fiscal impact, does anyone wish to speak to this amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
This came from the Children's Defense Fund, Ms. Jeffries and Ms. Fitzsimmons.
The WIC site will women, infant, and children. It's the WIC program, nutrition and food.
Ms. Fitzsimmons, are you wishing to speak to this amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is not my day with timeliness, apparently, so I apologize for that. What this amendment does is it expands where outreach is done on maternal depression and making certain that we are reaching reaching moms where we can. And just to give you just some quick background again, that it's estimated that WIC clinics actually serve half of all new moms and their infants at some period in time. And also the other background piece of information to provide would be that while 1 in 10 new moms suffers from maternal depression, that moms with low incomes experience depression at 3 to 6 times that rate.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rosen, Mr. Albrecht has advised us that this does not have a cost, so I would have no objection to putting it on the bill.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hand, and I did not have a chance to talk to you about the next 3 amendments that I offered. No, there's a few of them that are good.
Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of adopting the A5 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say no. The motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Senator Rosen, do you have another amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. And members and Senator Hand, this is the A16 amendment. This actually was one of my bills that did go. It's brought here by the long-term care folks. And it deals with the electronic health record system revolving account and loan program.
Senator Rosen offers the A16 amendment. Do you want to explain that any further, Senator Rosen, or is that adequate?
Basically, it's clarifies that nursing homes and assisted living establishments are considered priority providers for purposes of distribution of the electronic health record system revolving loan account. This will allow long-term care providers greater access to existing funds to implement health information technology. Department of Health should be fine with this amendment, and there is no cost to it. So it's just basically puts them on the list with other providers and makes them a priority too on the list. I shouldn't say a priority, but makes them equal with other folks.
Senator Hand, thoughts on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'm okay with putting this amendment on the bill.
Is there any question, members? Anyone wish to speak to this amendment? Seeing no interest, we will proceed to a vote. All those in favor of the A16 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say no. The motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now, Senator Hand, this is one I absolutely did not have a chance to talk to you, but it is a bill. We didn't have time to hear it. It is the A31 amendment.
Senator Rosen offers the A31 amendment.
And while that's being passed out, it's basically, and I will be honest, this does have background check study, and so perhaps that's why we never did get to it, because what we're doing here, we didn't want it to go into the big black hole Judiciary Committee. But basically right now, just nursing home workers, they need a background check, and if you are so right now, if you are just a temporary worker, every 45 days, you have to get a background check again. So we're extending this to 6 months because we know that there's a lot of people that work at our long-term care facilities that are summer day help or moms on maternity leave or college students who want to work over the holidays. And right now, after 45 days of being absent, they have to go back for a background check. And it seems to be a little onerous. This is in the House bill, Mr. Chair, or Senator Hand. And but it is a background check. So I will defer to your opinion on this.
Before commenting, Senator Hand, Senator Lori has a question.
Well, I have a little insight into this provision. We did have a similar provision in the DHS licensing bill, the OIG bill, and that is actually still alive. Senator Newman and I brought that through Judiciary this morning. It doesn't go all the way to 180 days, but it does give some relief, and DHS is on board with moving it from 45 to 90 days. And that did pass Judiciary, and we had a bit of a conversation about the background studies because that's a touchy subject. So, I mean, we did take it through those, you know, difficult waters. And it also has the traveling set-aside provision in a more robust manner so that it's – because the traveling set-aside for if you've already had a background study and you're changing jobs or something – it doesn't need to follow you. It's actually a pretty complicated provision. It needs to be in about five places, and that's also in that licensing bill. And so much of this is traveling separately, not exactly like this, but just for your information.
Okay.
Senator Hinn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rosen, are your thoughts that what's going on in the other bill might encompass the intent you're doing here? Or I am a little uncomfortable with some of this, and I don't necessarily want to bring it over to another committee and have them scope it out. But what's your thought on the bill that Senator Lori was describing?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hand, I'm very receptive to that, to other bill. Like I said, it is in the House, and the language is in the House traveling. So if that is something that we could take a look at and see, I'm not sure if I would assume it have to go through Judiciary because of the background check part of it. But that has been a problem. So
I see lawyerly heads nodding yes, Senator Rosen.
Well, and Mr. Chair, and
so
Senator
I can
Rosen.
Just I can table the amendment. I'll table the A31 amendment.
Senator, do you want to just withdraw your amendment, Senator Rosen?
Please. Mm-hmm.
Senator Rosen withdraws her amendment. Members, are there any other amendments to offer? Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, I've got the A8 amendment.
Senator Lori offers the A8.
Senator Han, I did give you a copy of this. This is actually included in the House bill as well, and it is asking for the – well, it's instructing the University of Minnesota to include in their biennial budget request in 2013 including a request for funding for investment in rural primary care training to be delivered by family practice residence programs to prepare doctors for the practice of primary care medicine in rural areas of the state. And it needs to provide for ongoing support for this rural primary care. You know, as we make cuts to our university system, the system tends to look towards the Twin Cities, and a lot of these really incredibly valuable rural residency programs are being starved in the current environment. And you know, the one I'm most familiar with is the one in Duluth, and it's really struggling, and it's been just such a phenomenal backbone for our rural primary care workforce that maintains the health of our whole region. And you know, they've graduated hundreds of graduates, and they have some of the best retention rates for practice in rural settings of anywhere. They have 61% of all graduates are still working in rural settings, and so this is just it doesn't cost anything now. It's just that the university should really give it some thought and put it in their request when they come next year, is all this says. And I actually kind of whispered in the ear of the higher ed chair, and she grumbled a little, but I don't know. She might have a thought or two.
Mr. Chair, I did make the suggestion that we pull the whole bill into higher ed. But Senator Lori talked me out of that. So...
So with that, I would offer the A8 amendment.
Thoughts, Senator Han?
Mr. Chair, just maybe from counsel, do we have the power to direct the University of Minnesota to do this kind of thing? I know there is a special status that the university enjoys, and I just wanted to know if we are permitted to do this, to direct them to do something like this.
Madam Chair and Senator Han, that's why it's request. Well, you've got must include a request.
That's a little pesky.
Is requested to include a couple places.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Newman, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I guess my thought was very similar to that of Senator Hans. If it was something that we would, in effect, allow the regents to do, but why would we want to mandate that the regents do this if they decide they don't want to? It may be a good idea to allow them to make a request for funding, but to require the regents at the University of Minnesota to do something, I'm not sure is a good idea, number one. Number two, I'm not even sure we have the authority to do it.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and members, I think as long as we're using the word request up in the header, on the last word of line 6, we could change the must to is requested to, which is really passive, but it would work.
Didn't we do a bunch of strongly encouraging?
Yeah, I was thinking that too.
I was going to suggest that.
I mean, honestly, the point of this is that the university really does need to give some serious thought to, and they do. I mean, they take these programs very, very seriously. But you know, in times of shrinking budgets, they tend to have they have a tendency to look towards the Twin Cities campuses, and you know, I just think in some of this rural primary care network, it's just so critical that we need to strongly encourage or something, try to prompt them to do a broader review of what we're losing here. And so the House did put this in their bill, so maybe they'd need to be corrected when we got to conference or something. But And so I'd be amenable to changing that must if we needed to some other language.
Senator Hahn?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Laurie and perhaps Council, if we took the must on line 1.6 and deleted the word must and replaced it with is encouraged to, we'll leave the strongly off. We'll just assume that they,
you've been in
they know.
Too long.
And then also on line 1.19 to strike the word must and replace that with should be encouraged to. And would that, Senator Laurie, would that kind of meet your intent here and we can sort of hash it out?
Yes, Chair. Senator Hahn, that'd be amenable to me. I don't want to start.
It's not okay with Senator Higgins, though. Senator Higgins.
I don't think you can, Madam Chair, I don't think you can request, I don't think you can encourage a request.
Madam Chair, I think on line 6.
Ms. Kavanaugh.
You delete must and say is encouraged to, and then on line 7, delete a request for. So it would be to is encouraged to include funding for an investment in rural.
I don't. Madam Chair's Council, I don't think so because
nine.
I don't think the Board of Regents, this is what they send to MMB. They send a request to MMB for funding, and then that comes to us, and we provide funding. So, I mean, we are encouraging them to include in the request that they provide to the legislature a recommendation for funding for these programs. So, I mean, it is, I think, is encouraged to include a request for funding is actually
I think that's
proper.
Right. Yeah. And then on line
Senator
9.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, on line 9, the must probably could just become a should.
Yeah, I think.
Is encouraged to provide?
Should provide.
I think the funding request should provide is probably good enough.
Okay. Senator Hahn?
Madam Chair, if those oral amendments could be incorporated into the 8, I'd certainly have no objection to putting it in the bill.
Okay. Is everybody clear on those? On line 1.6, delete must and insert is encouraged to. And on line 1.9, delete must and it say should provide. Those are oral amendments that Senator Laurie has moved. Any further questions, advice, Senator Hahn, on the A6 amendment?
As amended, I'm fine with the amendment.
Okay. All those in favor of the A8 amendment as with the oral amendments, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Okay. Further amendments? All clear over there? Further amendments? Senator Nino?
Actually, just a question, Madam Chair. I was unclear if Senator Hahn had wanted to amend the previous bill onto this or just let it run on its own.
Senator Hahn?
Madam Chair, I do want to do that, but I do have a couple of amendments that I'd like to introduce. I wanted to give others their opportunity to do that. But with the tolerance of the committee, I'd like to offer the A-19 amendment.
The A-19?
Yes.
Yes.
And I would like to ask if Ms. Henry is here to come up and talk about this. This is an amendment that she brought to me earlier, and I agreed to offer it. And my understanding is that there is not a fiscal cost to this, and perhaps she could be encouraged to explain a little bit more in detail than I can what the amendment does.
Ms. Henry,
thank
welcome.
You, Madam Chair and members. There is a technical amendment. First, the
Mr. Lueco.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, on the A-19 amendment, page 1, line 34, that line should be deleted and instead insert the words page 21, comma, after line 18, insert colon. And then on line, page 1, line 35, the paragraph F should read paragraph G. And so, again, this should not be replacing the paragraph, but should be adding the language.
Okay. Senator Hahn moves those oral amendments. Any question on those oral changes? Okay. Ms. Henry.
Thank you. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center, and thank you, Senator Han, for offering this amendment. This language is meant to establish a need determination process across the state to try to mitigate a cut that was made last year during the shutdown. And that cut was to close 128 adult foster beds, each one as soon as a person moved out. And that's been a big problem for a lot of us because we think that the providers that are helping people get independent and move out are not the providers we want to shut down because we're going to take their beds away. We need that capacity for people who are getting out of psychiatric units or for people getting out of Courage Center to go to a foster, to go to this program, learn the skills for independence, and then move out into the community. So that capacity is needed. We also find that we don't have a good idea of what the needs are across the state. And so we took language that's already in law to have a long-term care report that it only governs seniors now and added people with disabilities to it. And the department is fine with doing that. And then we added language in all the places. There were three places in law for that 128-bed cut last year, saying that the department could go ahead with those cuts, mandatory bed closures, unless there were voluntary projects that closed beds that could take the place of the mandatory. And so we set up a process where DHS can gather information, participate with stakeholders, and solicit proposals for changing services, because we know there are people who do want to change the configuration of services they have now, and they can close beds. And we thought a voluntary process to save that $1.3 million would be far better than the mandatory process to close beds in programs we think we need to keep. So that's really what the money the language does. It does not have a cost. There's funding in the bill that was in the bill last year, and that funding is still the same so that they can go ahead and gather data. And the department is here to give information about their participation as well. And we have, I think, a lot of support and agreement from counties and from providers and so on to try to undertake a better process.
Great. Senator Han.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I certainly would invite the department if they wish to make a comment briefly on this, just so we're clear on the agreement that we have.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. I can confirm that what Ann Henry described is correct, that we have agreed that this bill does not have a cost because it's using funds that currently exist to help fund this needs assessment process.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Hamilton? Or Ms. Henry?
Nope.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
On the last page, line 7, line 6, excuse me. The commissioner is providing a report back to the chair and should we do the traditional ranking minority members as well?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Senator Han, would you like to make that oral amendment?
Madam Chair, yes. Thank you, Senator Higgins.
Yes. All that.
So if we can
clear on that?
Direct counsel to note that amendment.
Thank you, Senator Higgins, for that. Okay, any further questions on the A-19 amendment as orally amended?
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Are there really businesses who will willingly, or what do we say, voluntarily give up those beds?
Ms. Henry?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, it's my understanding that there are providers who feel that the people they're serving could be served better, say, in apartments, and that they are ready to close out that adult foster home. The department has told me that they would really like the authority to solicit proposals in areas where they think that this will make a difference. Counties will be involved as well. For instance, Hennepin County is very supportive of this. It really would allow the opportunity to update the services in your area. through a voluntary and sort of collaborative process.
Okay. Just curious.
Okay. Good. So Senator Hand moves the A-19 amendment as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay. A-19 amendment is adopted. Senator Hand, you had another one.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd also like to offer the A-24 amendment and invite Ms. Commit to come forward to help explain what this amendment does. My understanding is that it also does not have a fiscal cost.
Hi, Ms. Commit.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit. I'm here representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And thank you, Senator Hand, for offering this amendment. This amendment makes a couple of changes.
Thank you.
And there are a couple of oral amendments or oral changes that we have to make to this written amendment. Where I'd like to start is on page one, line six. This is the this is language that relates to some changes that were made last session to require a family deductible be imposed on people covered in the state Medicaid program, and it has been exceedingly difficult to implement this this change. And so what we've decided to do in order to avoid any kind of a fiscal impact is just insert the language on the new language down on line 1.31. And I have an oral amendment at the end of that line that the department has asked if we would put it in for comfort language, and we're fine with that. So on line 1.32, before the period, we would want to insert within the existing capitation rates on an ongoing basis.
Did everybody get that oral amendment? Within the existing capitation rates on an ongoing basis? Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. Then I would also just say at the top of the same page, lines 1.3 and 1.4 should be deleted.
Delete lines 1.3 and 1.4.
Strike them. Yes, thank you.
Senator Hahn, are you fine with those? Yep. Ms. Commit?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then the remainder of the amendment simply puts into statute language relating to the withholds that the health plans are required to participate in. This just brings the language, makes the language current with what's in existing contracts and that sort of thing. And this is language we've worked on with the Department of Human Services. And they are in agreement with it. I do have one small change on line 7.33. And this was our oversight. The word on line 7.33, delete the word evaluate and insert the word consider. And that just makes it consistent with all of the other provisions within that part of the amendment.
Okay. Any questions on that oral piece? Okay.
And Madam Chair, the last comment is just to ask the Commissioner of on line page 9, line 28, just to request that we look at how to develop recommendations to develop a revised cost-sharing structure for state public health care programs.
Ms. Commit, what was that now on line 28?
On page 9 of line 28, it's just a request to work together with the Department of Human Services to develop some recommendations on how to implement an improved cost-sharing structure for state public health care programs that will actually work for the enrollees who are served.
Okay. Great. Senator Hahn?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Commit. I just wanted to invite the department if they wish to come forward and offer any additional comments on the amendment.
Okay. Anybody from the department like to comment on this amendment?
Madam Chair, I'm being told that they are fine with the amendment. And
okay. Mr. Leitz is shaking his head, yes? Okay. Further questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hahn, if we go to the first page, I think it was the line 131, 132. Am I understanding this correctly, that the deductible that we that is, you know, or the deductible that can be waived is the cost-sharing deductibles beginning at line 11, you know, through line 19? So we're talking about $3 for deductibles. Am I understanding that correctly?
Ms. Commit?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Newman. Actually, this relates to some language. That's the cost sharing, so sort of like a copay that an individual might pay. But what we're talking about is a deductible that was inserted in the omnibus bill last session as a way to help balance the budget. And this had to do with requiring that there could be a family deductible, I think in the neighborhood of around $20. But in order to actually implement it, it has to be adjusted dollar by dollar, and it's this enormously complicated process. And so rather than doing that, we will just make it a cost to the health plans to have to implement it.
Senator Newman?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. It just sounds or looks to me like we are figuring out a way to not have the folks involved in the plan have any skin in the game. That's what it sounds like to me. And I'm just questioning it.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and certainly can be corrected. And Senator Newman, my understanding is that it's really a question of the process that they need to go through to make this work is probably more burdensome and more costly than not having it there altogether. And so I don't disagree with your point, but it may be one of those things that is not really financially doesn't make sense. And maybe you can comment on that.
And Madam Ms. Chair, Senator Newman, this doesn't take away from the savings that the state will be achieving with this language that passed. It just means that rather than it coming from trying to get this deductible from the individual enrollees, it will just be something that will be part of the overall capitation that the health plans receive.
Chair, Senator Newman?
Yeah, I understand that. I really do. And I understand that it's likely more expensive to implement than what it's going to save. But the bottom line is that you are, in fact, eliminating the personal responsibility of the people involved in the plan.
Okay. Further questions, comments on the A24 amendment as amended? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say nay. A24 amendment is adopted. Senator Hahn?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A7 amendment, and this was something that was brought to me by ARM. I'd like to invite Mr. Nelson to come forward to some explanation.
Hi, Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, I am Bruce Nelson with ARM, and we did bring forth this amendment. I know many of you have talked with a lot of people.
Mr. Nelson, can you bring that forward?
Yes, thank you. About the 10% low need cut in congregate care. And what we're proposing here is a way to help deal with that cut. Many of the people who did receive that reduction are, in fact, lower need. There are people that, in many provisions in the bill, we're trying to facilitate to move out of corporate foster care into other settings because we can provide their services for less money. So what we're trying to do here is say that the counties who already have the authority and the ability to have a conversation with the providers about the services provided to individuals, to have that conversation with providers, and to see if there can be a service reduction that might be appropriate for those individuals. This would be a way then to help absorb the cost of the 10% per person reduction. As I said, many of the people are lower need, don't need that level of services, and so what we want to do is ensure that those conversations happen. Many of the counties are doing this, but not all. And so we're asking that let's take a look at this and be able to facilitate what was, I think, the intent, and that was to find the people who are or do have lower needs and to adjust the services commensurate with the resources as we move forward.
Okay. Any questions on this amendment? Senator Hamm?
I would move the adoption of the A7 amendment.
Okay. All those in favor of the A7 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. A7 amendment is adopted. Senator Hamm?
Yes, and I don't have just a couple of brief ones here left. The A26 amendment. And as that's being distributed, members, this is a bill that was actually authored by Senator Vandeveer, and somehow in the process it was overlooked, and we did intend to give it a hearing, but we just ran out of time. And so this amendment is not the bill, but it is a something that is derived from the bill. And what it is doing is asking for an appropriation of $10,000 to go to the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board to provide a grant to look at the costs of uncompensated care that are a result of emergency responses on interstates. And this idea was brought to Senator Vandeveer, as I understand it, by in his district. But I think that what they're interested in is getting a better idea of what these costs are. The bill itself was a more expansive attempt to try to address that problem by appropriating some money and trying to find a way to compensate for that. But I think instead of that, because we were not able to hear the bill, what they're really asking for is just this appropriation to allow them to study that issue and provide a report.
Okay. Any questions on this A26 amendment? Be kind of interesting to find out where these people are from and reasons why they are hitting the emergency rooms when they're on the highways. All those in favor of the A26 amendment, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, say nay. A26 amendment is adopted. Thank you, Senator Hamm.
I believe this is my last written amendment that I know of. It would be the A13 amendment.
A13 amendment.
And members, this is some language that we had adopted earlier on the bill that Senator Nino had in this committee a week or so ago, and it calls for the study of managed care and also a study of for-profit health maintenance organizations. It also includes the mandatory HMO participation repealer. So this is language that we have seen before and was adopted onto the bill that Senator Nino had, but I'd like to include it into the omnibus bill.
Senator Hanna, is there a fiscal note on this for this study?
Pardon me?
Is there a fiscal note on this?
And Mr. Albrecht can clarify. I believe there was a cost to do the study, but I'm not clear. Maybe you can help us out.
Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, I believe these are the same two studies that were once amended onto Senate File 1824, Senator Nienau's bill.
Yes.
I would expect that these are included in what is currently an incomplete fiscal note for that bill in the Department of Health section. So, and I'm pretty sure there would be costs, but I don't know what they are.
Okay. Further questions on the A13 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. A13 amendment is adopted. Senator Hand?
And then the last thing, Madam Chair, with Senator Enow's permission, in addition to having the bill that we heard earlier move on to on its own, I wanted to also adopt his language into this bill just so that we can make sure that it does proceed and not get hung up along the way, that we want that language to be available.
Okay. And Senator Hand, that's the Senate file 1824?
Yes, and if Senator Enow wants to comment, but I would.
Senator Enow, do you have a amendment?
That's fine. Okay. I believe the Enow? Motion would be to amend the language of Senate File 1824 as amended.
Okay. Any further questions? Oh, well, we'll do that motion and then pass the whole bill. All those in favor of amending Senate File 1824 onto Senate File 2093, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
And Madam
Senator
Chair?
Hand?
As far as I know, that is all the amendments that we have. Not seeing anybody.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Higgins.
As Senator Hand, I didn't realize this was going to turn into an omnibus bill when the day started. but my little Weber pool, the natural swimming pool bill, I think if it's okay with you, I'll try to get that amendment for the Finance Committee and we can add it as well. That'd be all right.
Remind me again. That was
it's the natural swimming pool. Kind of a what would we say? It's an exemption from swimming pool rules because it's done in the European fashion.
I remember that, and I'm certainly
Senator Hand.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I do remember talking with Senator Higgins about that issue and would be amenable to including that in the bill as well.
Right. Senator Higgins, your motion is to amend.
Madam Chair, could we just put it on without it? Can we insert the language from that bill, or we can put it in finance, either way? You put it in now?
Senator Higgins, we'll do it in finance.
We'll do it in finance.
Finance?
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Super. All right. All those. Any more questions on the Senate File 2093, the Omnibus Health Bill?
Oh, maybe.
As amended.
Madam Chair, just one comment.
Yes, please, Senator Higgins.
We came in with the bill about 70 pages long. I think we've done good work to about double the size of it.
That's a good, nice
to make it a real omnibus bill. I appreciate the patience of the members of the committee and look forward to working with you as we go through conference process.
Thank you, Senator Hand. Nice job. Further questions on Senate File 2093? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank
Good
you.
Job, Senator Hand. Thank you, members.
We adjourn?
Okay. Oh, by the way, leftovers? Yeah, it's gotten to be a long day.
I started early morning.
Yeah.
4:30 in the morning.
I need a nap. I am not. Not at 4:30 in the morning.
You have a lovely evening.
Yeah, bright and early.
Yeah, I don't know the number either.